This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes.
Why would you bring this chair down? Do you
want this? I think I brought that chair down last week.
Dennis, why would you bring that chair down?
Anyway,
this is my leaping question is, he leaps into the body of a person who's alive. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that person goes while he's in there, but then when he leaps out again, does the person have a memory of what just happened?
So first off, to clarify, he doesn't leap into their body.
Oh, okay.
He physically replaces them, and everybody just sees the aura of the person that he's placed surrounding them. Okay. So if he leaps into a blind man, he can still see.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
If he leaps into a woman, he is physically there and he's got all of his equipment.
Got it.
Yes.
But they see, yeah.
The person that he replaced leaps into the future and hangs out in a room at Project Quantum Leap called the waiting room, where he, for the most part, he looks like Sam. They have a Swiss cheese memory just like Sam does. And we've had debates before about, do they have any memory when they leap back? And more or less, no.
At one point, I think the creator of the show actually did say something at a fan convention where the idea was is that when they, like, replaced him, that they did get an idea of some of what had happened while they were gone.
Okay.
So in other words, they would kind of get a little bit of Sam's memories from that time while Sam was there, so that they wouldn't just come back and be like, the hell happened for the past week?
Right.
You know?
Well, especially in the case of the last... We're not recording yet, are we?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're in.
Like, here was this guy who was, like, clearly a bigot. It's like, Sam tried to be like, don't talk like that around me.
Talking about,
like,
so help me God, yeah.
Yes, he's still going to be like a big giant bigot when he comes back, or is he going to be like changed a little?
That is a fantastic question. It's a valid question, and I don't think it's something we'll ever get to know the answers to. Although, one of the devices that they do start to put into the show a little bit more that was absent from So Help Me God, and I wished it would have been there, was absent from Catch a Falling Star 2, is that Al would sometimes appear at the end of the episode right before Sam leaped out, and Al would sort of say, oh, so-and-so went on to do this, this, and this, or, you know, they live their life like this, or they... So it would kind of give you a bit of a bow on it, you know, and let you know that this is what happened. But that doesn't happen in every episode, especially early on. It became more of a regular device as the show went on. So you would get an idea, at least, of, like, where things were going, but you don't ever see really what happens to anybody afterwards, except for there are a couple of rare occurrences where it does happen, where there's like a sequel, but that's...
Did he leap really back? Rare. Does he ever leap back into the same person?
There's one case where, a couple seasons he comes back and he returns to someone's life.
But it gets... The episode itself gets kind of weird, and I mean that in a good way, because I actually like the episode. I know there's some people that don't, but it starts off kind of being like a regular sort of leap, and then you realize, I mean, I guess kind of early-ish, you realize that one of the characters is not exactly who they seem to be.
We keep the episodes relatively spoiler-free in case anybody is watching.
Oh, okay.
Like watching along with us, yeah.
Gotcha.
So speaking of those people listening in, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. We've been trying this thing the last couple episodes just sort of by accident, of sort of doing like a bit of a cold open, if you will. We hope you're enjoying it. I don't know if I'm going to leave the bit about Jessica complaining about the chair or not.
Sure.
But I might just do it.
That was my fault. I brought it down.
But welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, and we're here at Project Quantum Leap discussing the episode Catch a Falling Star. And we are joined today by our guests, returning my wife Jessica Conger, and then our friend Brooke Allen. Brooke, would you like to say hello?
Hello, Quantum Leap fans that are part of a Quantum Leap fan club.
Sure.
I watched this show because my older brother was watching it when I was a kid, and that's the last I ever saw of it until the other night.
Until it resurfaced. Until Dennis made me do it. Yes.
And it looks like you guys have, like, books about it.
Oh, we do.
Yeah.
I do. I have a few. And Dennis, actually, funny story, the book that Dennis is holding, Beyond the Mirror Image, An Observer's Guide to Quantum Leap by Matt Dale, was actually a wedding gift for me that he bought for me, and he specifically told me not to open it until after we got back from our honeymoon.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Because you're, yeah. Yeah. Betsy lost me for a couple weeks after I bought this book. It is exhaustive.
And it's kind of funny because we...
I mean that in a good way.
When we first met, early on, it came up that we both liked Quantum Leap because Dennis had some of the DVD box sets, and so we talked about it a little bit, and he knew I liked it, I knew he liked it. And then we realized, oh, no, you don't just like it, you love it. Mm-hmm. And I clued him into when the Blu-rays were coming out, and he got me this book. And it's kind of like we've always been on a path towards doing the podcast.
Yes, so. Yeah.
But speaking of paths, so I met Brooke because she wrote a show that I was in.
I totally forgot that connection.
Yeah. That you directed.
Yes. I remember directing the show. Yeah. I totally forgot that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was a fun show. It really was.
That was one of the things that I am most proud of that I've worked on. And I'm bummed because I feel like not enough people saw it.
Yeah.
Because it was part of a weird 10-minute play festival where some of the plays were more like 30 minutes, and
so people
and
left
your
after
piece
the first
was like smack in the middle of the second act, and
yeah.
I don't know how many times you went back and saw the show.
I saw it twice
afterwards. Same here, but I heard that more and more audiences left at the first act because the first act ran. So long.
Well, there was one piece in the first act that wasn't so good. But anyway.
Like, that was a play, I don't think I'd even met you until I'd seen you.
And
that was one of those plays where it's like, as a playwright, you nervously just, like, cross your fingers and hope everyone got it.
Yeah.
And I was like, at the end, I was like, that was, like, perfect.
Yeah.
That was so
great.
I was so happy. I just remember being, like, gushing and being like, thank you, Dennis.
It was fun. It was a relatively straightforward piece and a festival of weird.
It was.
Which almost made it the weird piece. But, you know, honestly, like, I have to say, too, and it's interesting because sometimes you get the opportunity to work on shows that are, like, 2.5-3 hours long. You're doing Shakespeare, you're doing this or whatever. And this was, I think we were, like, 12 to 13 minutes long. And I honestly think that it's probably one of the things that I'm most proud of.
Aww.
And certainly, like, in Chicago, it's the thing I'm most proud of. Like, I've done a few things, like, other places, and I was like, yeah, that was great or whatever, but this was something that I was just like, man, all right.
That's cool.
For me personally, like, there are some shows that I've been involved in since I got here that I thought were, like, really good shows, but I was sort of like, eh, I kind of sucked. But, but this was something where I was just like, all right, we got this.
It was fun to write. It was sort of an easy to write.
Yeah.
Like, in the sense that it just came quickly, and I was done with it, and I was like, well, wow.
Good
job.
And for those of us who weren't there, 99%, it was a short piece about a guy who was about ready to abandon his family, and he's basically telling his infant child, like, why he's about to crawl out the window after putting him to bed.
Yeah.
Like, doing it by way of telling a fairy tale of King Charlie, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, King Charlie was once in a rock band, and then he met a woman, and then...
Played at the double door.
No longer there.
But
by the end, he just collapses and grabs the baby and gushes. Yeah.
And it was cool because one of the things that each piece was inspired by a song off of the album OK Computer by Radiohead. That was like the idea of the cycle. And your song was No Surprises, which is one of my favorite songs on album, too. So I was just sort of like, oh, this is great.
Well, I didn't know everyone else was going to do sci-fi. And that song sort of had like a lullaby strain in it.
I even played
which you ended up playing
the intro.
Yeah. And so I wanted something with a baby, and then there it was. But I was surprised, too, because I saw the rest of the festival, and I was like, oops.
You know, the thing is, though, is that there were so many people, though, that had really nice things to say about it, including, like, Dan, for instance, and since the project was kind of, you know, he was the one that was sort of, like, shepherding everything into existence in a way, you know, it certainly had his stamp of approval. I know he was really excited about it, and some other people said the same thing, so some of the other company members and stuff. So here we all are.
This has been a great podcast.
Thank you for joining us. it was cool. It was a little nerve wracking, though, I have to say, because I was the only person on stage for the bulk of the thing. You know, me and a rubber baby. But apparently, I did a better job than Bradley Cooper in American Sniper. So I'm happy about that.
Oh, that baby! I heard about that baby, and then I went back and watched it. And I was like, oh.
I just watched that scene. I haven't seen the whole movie, but I did watch that.
You watch stuff like that, and you're like, wasn't there one person
somewhere that was like... So basically, I read, like, what had happened was, is that on the day that they were shooting, their primary baby was sick that they were going to use. The other baby wasn't available. And Clint Eastwood was just like a very practical, like no, we're not gonna shift around the shooting schedule. We're not gonna do anything. Here's a rubber baby. Bounce the arm up and down. Just do it.
I guess the thing for me is that, like, so I grew up, and this will tie into our thing today. Yeah. But I grew up in the summers in Summer Stock Theater, and because my parents ran a Summer Stock Theater.
Oh, nice.
And it's like, things would happen. Like, I remember one time during Jesus Christ Superstar, one of the apostles got the stomach flu and couldn't go on. We're like, there's only 11 apostles. And we, like, threw my stepdad in a robe and, like, shoved him on stage. You know what I mean? Like, he just, like, carried a loaf of bread around. Like, that kind of stuff happens, like, in Summer Stock Theater. But, like, in Hollywood, you imagine that there's time to
somebody
go find a baby somewhere.
Big
budget. Yeah.
You know, it's not Summer Stock. Like, you don't have to...
Clint Eastwood, you know, he once talked to a chair for 20 minutes, so he was probably like...
He was...
No one's paying attention to the baby.
Yeah. In all fairness, as an artist, I actually do like Clint Eastwood quite a lot. I think he's a great director.
Not a great props designer.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, funny enough, as we've sat here and talked about anything but Quantum Leap, this actually does lend itself well to the conversation we're about to have about the episode, because it does take place... And in fact, our episode is entitled Catch a Falling Star. It was indeed... directed... by Donald Belisario, and written by Paul Brown. The leap date is May 21st, 1979. Our air date is December the 6th, 1989, and Sam has leapt into Ray Hutton, the understudy for the role of Cervantes. And Dennis, TV Guide?
The TV Guide description is, talk about impossible dreams.
Of course it does.
An understudy for a bawdy stage veteran. In a way off-Broadway production of The Man of La Mancha, Sam meets a woman he loved when she was too old for him in his real life, but who's now the stage partner and friend of the actor he's leaped into.
Well, how about that?
And that is going to lead into an interesting conversation that we've already touched on in a couple of previous episodes.
Yeah.
Jessica, I think you know what we're talking about. When we get to that point, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut, and I'm just going to see what you women say, because I'm just interested in your opinion before we interject and start talking about it.
Yeah.
I bet I know where you're going with that.
Yeah.
So before we get there, so as has become the standard, and one of the things that we've talked about, the leap out from the previous episode tends to be a fairly condensed version of the leap in. So the scene that we get at the very top of this episode is actually a little bit longer than what we get at the end of the last episode, which is notable for the fact that it's... Well, quite frankly, it's very noticeable.
Yeah.
Because there are things that happen in the extended scene that make continuity not really match up in the previous episode's leap out.
Sure.
Such as the mustache getting ripped off and, you know, put back on and that sort of stuff. But we see a maybe director, maybe even stage manager, maybe producer, some sort of theatrical fellow in a managerial capacity who runs in and says... 50 seconds! And it reminds me a lot of Martin Short in this particular scene, honestly.
Interesting, okay.
While Sam is getting made up in the chair, and, eventually, you know, fish out of water expression on his face, but eventually he gets pushed out into the wings, and you know, he's given the book and he's got the cape on and he's getting ready to go up the stairs, and we get our oh boy moment.
Yeah. Or yeah, break a leg, you're on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that would never happen because it's the start of the show, right? That was
the top of the show.
Yeah. So the stage manager is going to call places, and the PA, the production assistants backstage, are going to let the stage manager know once everyone's there. They're not going to just, like, let the show start with an actor, like, still down in the dressing room. They're going to hold the house.
In theory,
it's
true.
Yes.
But do you happen to recall a time when David Alan Anderson threw out his back on Christmas Carol and an understudy by the name of Sam Fain was called to go on and was pacing around downstairs because they were still getting a costume together for him, and it was a student matinee, so they couldn't hold the house too long. So,
yeah,
like,
but they wouldn't have, like, opened the curtains or whatever without knowing the actor was standing right there.
Sure. Although, extenuating circumstances, Mr. O'Malley, our real star of the show, is drunk.
That's true.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was sort of touch and go whether or not he could have been sitting down there waiting, and they were like, all right, no, you're good. No, wait, no, we do need you.
I think what I thought was even funnier is that this, like, Syracuse off, like, not way off Broadway, I mean, it's in Syracuse.
Right.
Performance of Man of La Mancha has, like, thousands of people in the audience, and it has understudies for every role, and there's a makeup artist.
Yeah, really? Yes. Nice costume.
Like,
has
wow.
a pretty good set.
Box seats. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, understudy rehearsals going on. I was like, this is a major Syracuse production.
Although
yeah.
she was cast, it seemed like, one of the understudies after the show had already opened.
Well,
yeah.
It makes me... But there is a question, actually, though. Does it ever get explicitly stated, or is it just hinted at, that this is actually a touring production?
Oh.
So they're not, like, based in Syracuse, that it's actually a touring production. Because I think that one of, like, O'Malley says something at one point, or you get the idea at the opening night party, which is not really opening night, but it's opening night for Syracuse.
Oh,
and that they've been actually working on this show for a while.
So they're casting local people, maybe, as the...
That was the vibe that I got.
And he's clearly very famous, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but again, I don't know that it's ever explicitly stated.
I mean, that makes sense when they say that, yeah, that Ray, the person that Sam has leaped into,
yeah.
he's been touring with not just this show, but other shows.
But other shows as well, yeah. Which is also funny, because one of the things that, this I know is going a little out of order, but it made me think of it, is I love Al's moment about saying that, like, how Ray is in the waiting room entertaining everybody singing songs from, like,
Oklahoma.
Various musicals.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Oklahoma
oh, yeah.
being one.
But anyway, so Sam thinks he's about to go on, we get the opening credits, and then we come back... that's when John shows up. Or not John.
Yeah.
John O'Malley.
John O'Malley.
Oh, I got confused. Played by
John
Cullum.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
I have to say, when he was, like, standing there about to go on, and he was like, you know, one second. And I turned to Sam, and I was like, oh, I've had this dream before.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah.
The
actor's nightmare.
The stereotypical actor's nightmare, in case anyone listening doesn't know, is, like, you're afraid you're going to go on for a show that you're not prepared for.
You're on stage, and
I got the
stuff things happening around you. And
yeah.
You have no idea what even the show
is. Yeah. My actor's nightmare, my variation on it, is that I am in the remount of a show that I've done previously, and I got cocky and I thought, well, I don't need to study my lines, I've done the show before, and
good
we get
boy.
To opening night and I'm about ready to walk on stage and I realize I don't know my lines because I never looked at them because I thought I had them. That's my variation.
Yeah. I had the actor's nightmare come true once. I walked on stage. Yeah, I did very little acting, but I definitely played a bunny in Bambi at the Somerset Theater, and because we did children's shows in the daytime. And I walked on stage and just forgot every single thing, the whole entire scene.
Oh, no.
And then I walked on stage and I went, "Hi, Bambi," and the actor goes, "Hi," and I went, "Well, bye," and I hopped off stage and I got backstage and I was like, "I don't know what just happened," and then the guy was like, "I wish the rabbit had stayed. I would have told her. And then my mother died. And blah, blah, blah." And I just remember being backstage, and he came running off for a quick change, and he's like, "I'm going to kill you."
Oh.
And I was like, "Oh." And thus ended my acting career.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I don't have the actor's nightmare anymore, because I lived through it.
You absolve yourself.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
But it sort of, like, turns into it goes from the actor's nightmare in this episode to, like, the actor's sort of wet dream, doesn't it? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Really does.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. So John shows up and shoves off, and everybody's like, oh, sorry, maybe... Maybe next time.
One of my favorite moments is when he rips off Sam's mustache.
Yeah. Imposter.
And yeah, but then just like throws it away. Like, he doesn't need the mustache. He doesn't go on with the mustache.
He puts it on stage.
That's the thing. Like, later on, like later when they cut to like when Al says, "Oh, you need to watch him. He's brilliant."
Yeah.
He starts to sing, "I am Don Quixote."
Yeah.
Like yeah, he has a mustache and he has a goatee on.
Right.
At that point, which already.
Which is the tradition for the musical is that obviously the actor that plays Cervantes / Don Quixote, he ends up putting on
the thing,
the stuff on stage. And it's interesting too because later in the episode, when Sam does finally go on, spoilers, he has more of like a beard and a full facial hair thing than just the mustache. But yeah, I just thought that was really interesting. It's like they give him the mustache, and the only thing that I can rationalize is because Ray is so much younger than John O'Malley. That they decided that they wanted to age him up.
Or
they got to do something.
Cutting out some of the business when you put an understudy on. Sometimes you kind of pare down what they have to do.
Sure.
So they, have less to remember in the moment. So maybe they were like, "Well, don't worry about getting yourself ready. Like, just
we're gonna put that
you're
on.
You're just gonna be ready."
Yeah. But so it's interesting to note before John shows up, there is a shot of the actor who we're going to learn is Michelle. Dancing across the stage is Dulcinea.
Yes.
And even though it's a few moments before we're introduced to her, you can see the character Nicole standing on the other side in the wings.
Which is a shot that they reuse at the end of the episode.
That's what I was going to say. Yes, they reuse that same shot at the end of the episode.
Only it doesn't work because Nicole's on stage.
Stage, yes. Anyway, TV shows saving money.
Wait, well, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, at the very end of the episode, they actually reuse that shot so that you can see Nicole in the purple dress in the wings, and it's like the same people in the boxes and everything.
But at this point, Nicole is supposed to be the one who's on stage performing.
So they just reuse the same
Watching that man. Anyway, we're jumping way ahead.
Right.
So John shows up. He starts the performance.
He does.
So this is when Al and Sam are backstage, and Al is telling Sam Ray's story.
And how much Al loves theater and that sort of stuff. Real quick,
Roar the grease paint, smell of the crowd.
Yeah,
you got that backwards. Well, you never did summer stuff.
You never did summer stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is probably true.
I forgot about Al. When he showed up, I was like, what is this?
Oh.
And it took me the longest time. I was like, what's happening? And I watched it with a friend of mine, and she's like, that's Al. Helps.
Like, all
right.
Yeah.
All
right. It is interesting because we've talked about this a bit without what would come to be known as the saga cell. There are things that you don't get. Whereas the opening narration where Sam is talking about, leaping around through time, sets up what he does, but it doesn't set up where he comes from necessarily, or Al, or any of that. Whereas the saga cell, which is coming soon, fans, don't worry, will actually say he is aided by a hologram from the future, his friend Al. It actually tells you everything you need to know, and then gets you into the episode really nicely. But at this point, it's interesting because I think you're the second or third person that has sort of mentioned, like...
Well, like, our guest,
where the hell is coming from?
Kathleen, that we had on a couple weeks ago, she had never seen an episode at all.
Uh-huh.
Anything. And so when Al shows up, she was like, oh, all right, guardian angel type person, sure.
Yeah.
Got an iPhone. And then she was like, wait, this was done like 30 years ago. Why does he have an iPhone?
Yeah. Oh, he's from the future?
Al?
Yeah.
Yeah, so his story is like, he is actually in the present. He just stands in a room called the imaging chamber that simultaneously projects his holographic image back into the past with Sam. And it also projects a hologram of everything in Sam's present around him.
Gotcha.
So that he can interact with him.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so he's a real flesh and blood person just existing in the future.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and in this particular scene, it's interesting because it does kind of play into that idea that, Al knows everything, and, for every episode he learns a new skill or something like that. But it is interesting that we get this information that
he was an amateur actor.
But the reason why he was is because he used that to get out of the orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really cool little touch. Like, I liked that idea that, like, this was something he could do so they didn't have to be in the orphanage all day. It's like, he went and did some theater.
There's a lot I don't know about Al.
I didn't know that either. That he was an orphanage. I missed that.
They dropped that in just a couple episodes ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because and again, the building blocks of it, it's interesting to see, and I know apologies, Brooke, Jessica, it doesn't mean as much to you, but as the progression, sort of the arc for Al's character, like the information we've learned so far this season, for instance, is, you know, how many times he's been married.
Mm-hmm. He's a retired admiral.
In the Navy. That his sister died in a mental institution, and she was mentally handicapped, and then that his father was like a construction worker and went to do this project in the Middle East and left them both in an orphanage, and you know, all sorts of interesting stuff.
Sure.
And that, you know, and that Al was
an astronaut
raised in an orphanage.
Wow.
So like we
Al's cool.
We've learned a lot about Al this season.
All right.
Yeah. So we get this information that he did theater
sure.
at some point to get out of the orphanage.
And so that Ray is a touring actor,
mm-hmm.
and it's at about this point, looking across the wings, Sam spots Nicole, and through some dialogue, we learn that Nicole was actual Sam's piano teacher
mm-hmm.
when he was a teenager, and it was his first case of being in love, puppy love.
Is it common for Sam to run into people from his own life when he leaves?
I think this is only the second time. Right?
When's the first time before
Donna?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He runs into the woman that he was supposed to marry, and then she ended up leaving him at the altar. Yeah, so this is the second time, and it's a former former lover. Or no, piano teacher.
Right.
Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Nicole and Ray were former lovers.
Yes.
Whoa, that's a whole other story. Anyway.
It was already creepy enough, Dennis, about you.
And it's neat, too, though, because this does sort of play into the fact that Sam was a piano player, which is something that we learned a few episodes back about how,
sure.
you know, he played and he was something of a, you know, prodigy growing up and that
yeah.
sort of thing. So we get a face to the faceless, nameless piano teacher. But
yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
He played Carnegie Hall
yeah.
when he was 16 years old.
Yeah.
Which basically means she taught him until he was 15, and then she left to go to study at Juilliard, and a year later he played
Carnegie Hall when he was 16
Syracuse.
Years old
yeah.
doing Syracuse. And I know we're jumping ahead here, but one of the things I forgot, she doesn't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like later on in the scene, like he starts playing his old warm-up song, hoping that she'll like get a cue.
Right.
And she basically says, like, oh yeah, one of my students used to play that, but I've had so many students I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember that prodigy that went to Carnegie Hall.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I know. It is, yeah. What are you gonna
so
do?
Anyway,
right.
so they see each other across from the wings and they recognize each other, but Sam recognizes her as his piano teacher. She recognizes him because
they went to Juilliard together.
Nicole and Ray went to Juilliard together, and we're gonna find out here in a little bit. They were lovers for a time.
Indeed. And
Sam thinks that for a minute, Sam's like, she sees me.
She knows
yeah.
who I am.
She knows it's me.
Yeah.
Oh, Sam.
Oh, Sam.
Bless your heart.
And this is also where Al tells him the mission, right? That he's got to stop John from going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, so 3 days benefit performance. He's going to do a Gerald Ford impersonation.
Yeah.
Off of the stairs.
It's the second time this season we get a reference
to Gerald
Ford.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To falling off the stairs and literally breaking his leg.
We watched it last night and she was like, it's usually a little more of an exciting plot than this.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's like, this is a strange episode. And I don't know because I haven't seen it all, but
mm-hmm.
she's like, it's usually like a little more involved than just like catch a guy who's going to fall.
Sure. Yeah.
That is absolutely
this
true.
Was,
yeah.
I didn't really like this one so much. I thought there was a lot of creepiness, and also the plot was very thin. But
yeah.
I think it was there were a couple things I did really like that we'll talk more about later. But it did seem like it was just a vehicle
yes.
for him to
sing. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should note,
Scott Bakula was
yeah.
like, to play Don Quixote.
Yeah.
Here's
well,
how
well,
he's
yes.
going to do it.
I was going to say, we were texting back and forth last night. Like,
yeah.
For anyone who may not know, Scott Bakula actually was an accomplished Broadway performer
mm-hmm.
before Quantum Leap. He had been nominated for a Tony a year or two before Quantum Leap began
yeah.
for Romance,
mm-hmm.
which was like, I understand it was like a critical favorite, but a financial flop.
Yeah.
But he still got nominated for a Tony. He actually did play Don Quixote in a summer stock
yep.
performance somewhere around St.
Louis yeah.
in college.
Oh,
yep.
wow.
Yeah.
I bet that was at the Muni.
Probably.
That's this, like, outdoor
yeah.
summer
yes.
stock.
Yes, totally.
And... can I just sidestep with the
yeah,
oh, okay. This show is nothing if not sidesteps.
They did. I did not see it, but when I went to school in St. Louis, and one summer the Muni did Miss Saigon, which I'm sure was with all white people,
mm.
and they were like, they got the Channel 5 news chopper to be the helicopter.
Oh,
but only because they kept it with, like, the St. Louis Channel 5, like, as promotion on the
yeah.
side of the helicopter.
God.
Oh, my God.
And
oh.
so, like, every night the people were saved by the St. Louis Channel 5 news team.
Oh, my God.
That's really funny.
That was really funny.
Oh,
wow.
It might be an urban legend. But,
I
heard that story a lot in college, and we always, like, laughed so hard and thought it was so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I part of me wants it to be true.
And
then part of me
I
hopes
don't
it's want to not.
Research it because I feel like that story might. As I was telling it, I was like, "That can't possibly be
true." But yeah, no,
and I did.
Like,
but it is a story that's told throughout the land,
mm-hmm.
throughout the St. Louis land.
Yeah,
never know.
We're gonna tell a lot of theater stories.
We are. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
like
yeah,
I would jump back and say, like, yeah, when John shows up plastered, he reminded me of somebody I knew in college because I did like 2 years of community college and then I transferred to university. The ironic thing is that the theater that I did shows in at community college is the most beautiful theater that I performed in during my academic career because they had a bunch of money, they had just
mm-hmm.
built it. A beautiful theater, local community theaters from the surrounding area, they also used the facilities. And so there's one local community theater who used it for some show, and me just being a student, like, I helped out backstage working one night, and the lead actor in the show, like, he is John O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was that guy.
Yeah.
We came face-to-face backstage at one point, and, like, his eyes were doing, like, the drunk floaty dance.
Yeah.
Oh, and, yeah.
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 Well, I worked on Man of La Mancha at Timberlake.
You said that, yeah.
Yeah, the Somerset Theater I worked on, I was 12,
mm-hmm.
and I ran the follow spot. Right, and so it was funny because in the episode there's like a huge spotlight on him, and I was like, no,
absolutely,
yeah.
But the guy, I don't remember his name, and I wouldn't probably say it if I did. But the guy who played Don Quixote notoriously could not remember his lines ever at all, any of them. But Don Quixote is this character who's sort of like, you know, fumbling in and out of.
Sure, yeah.
So it sort of worked. But we always would laugh backstage because we'd always say that he'd be like, to dream the impossible line. Like,
he just
would never know anything. I am I, line.
Oh, God.
Yeah, he was rough. So it reminded me a lot of him,
yeah.
too.
Now that I think about it, I think this guy that I just talked about, he had notorious line problems.
Yeah, as well.
I have another story about him later on. Show, but yeah, we'll get there.
Drinking
yeah.
and memory don't often mix.
Yes.
Yeah, I did. I worked with a guy who was quite well respected and really one of the sort of, you know, I don't say this at all tongue in cheek, I mean it sincerely, like major theatrical talents in Indianapolis. And, you know, he'd done a lot of work around there. You know, he'd done work in New York, he'd done work in L.A., done, you know, and I worked with him on a show, and it was just the two of us, and I go into rehearsal one day, you know, excited to get to work, and he was just plastered, like, to the point where I was just sort of like, am I going to have to, like, hold him up? Like, thank goodness it was just rehearsal, and at one point, I remember stepping outside, because the director and the playwright were outside, and they were smoking a cigarette, and I kind of stepped outside, and I was just sort of like, hey guys, and they just sort of like looked at me and they're kind of nodding their heads like, yeah, and the director started to say something to me and then the playwright was just like, just don't even, like, there's no reason to even, I mean, he's doing the best he can with what he's got right now. And it was like, okay, cool, so everybody knows, it's not like I'm not just standing there like, alright, like I was younger at the time. I think I was
sure.
like 25, 26,
yeah.
So I was early-ish, you know, in my career. But anyway, it happens.
Yeah.
They're out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we get the mission drop, what he's there to do,
yeah.
is to stop John from tripping off the stairs.
Yes.
Then the performance ends
with
Sam and Nicole
meet
backstage.
What an interesting flow of time they do there, because like one minute they're watching the very beginning of the show,
sure.
and then the next minute like we're hearing the Dulcinea song, and the next thing is the show is over and Sam's making a beeline for Nicole backstage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've just been staring at each other for 2 hours
yeah.
across
yeah.
the wings, just making eyes
she
at
didn't
each
have
other.
Any entrances over on
that,
so.
They're not watching
yeah.
the show at all.
Yeah, they're, yeah. But they meet up and like, yeah, Sam still thinks that she recognizes him,
yeah.
and then it becomes clear that she recognizes Ray, and that
right.
yeah.
they had a relationship before.
That they had a relationship, and but it sounds like Ray kind of ghosted her.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she greets him by kissing him full on the mouth, and which I was like, are they? It took me a minute to understand.
I think it's just a writing shorthand to say, hey, they used to be romantic together.
Yeah.
Just, yeah.
All right, sure.
Yeah. let's just get into it.
Okay, great.
Skip through any awkward bits and get right to the kissing.
Get right to the kissing, yeah. That was my dating philosophy.
It's an accommodation.
No!
Story.
No. Yeah.
Hence the restraining order.
Wait, yes, yes, yeah. But anyway, so in this we also find out that Michelle is the new understudy.
Nicole.
Played by.
She's played by Michelle.
This is where
actually.
I get the mix up, yeah.
Yeah, Michelle Pach is who plays her. But
she's also understudying the actress Michelle.
Yes,
yes.
Exactly. Who is indeed playing Aldonza Dulcinea, who yes. is Janine Turner
yes.
of Northern Exposure fame.
Yeah. John Cullum was also on Northern Exposure.
I was just curious about
which
John
doesn't
O'Malley
come up. John, yeah. Which
is played by John
start
Cullum
for another few
yeah.
months, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is interesting
that they would work together soon. It's really interesting too, because I knew that I recognized her and I knew that she was someone that had done other things, but I could not place her at first. And then when I realized who it was, I was like, well, no wonder, because she doesn't look quite like the Janine Turner that I think that we, because her hair's a little longer.
Sure.
Whereas like in Northern Exposure, she had like the pixie cut or kind of bob and this, you know. So it's interesting how a haircut really can change a person.
Well, then
sometimes
they put her in the Dulcinea wig that every actress has worn through the history of Man of La Mancha.
Yes.
As soon as they put it on her head, I was like, oh, the Dulcinea wig.
Oh, yeah.
The quote, Spanish lady wig. Like, it's the big, curly. Mm-hmm. I was laughing so hard. I was like, it's the go-to wig.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, so yeah, at some point, Ray had ghosted Nicole
yes.
over
yes.
the years, because like their letter writing had dropped off. But now they are hopeful that they may get to perform together.
Yes, and you know, Sam is. It's interesting here because
Sam is hopeful that they may get to perform together.
Well,
and they might because apparently the actress Michelle parties too hard on Saturday.
Yeah, this is where we get to the
like
party at the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's interesting here is that you get this sense from Sam that while he is clearly hopeful that Nicole knows that it's Sam, that he still has enough of that sort of leaper's mentality, if you will, that all right, I'll be Ray. I'll do what I need to do. I'm not going to confuse things too much. And yet, of course, he's clearly conflicted about that.
Sure.
For better or for worse.
Mm. Yeah, I was a little conflicted about that, I think.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So, to keep the flow of the episode.
Yes.
So,
yes.
They're at the after party. This is where we find out that Michelle does not like doing Sunday matinees.
Right.
And she pretty boldly implies that her and Ray
have
some kind of thing going on.
Yes.
And
she flashed him while she was on stage.
That's true. She did.
Yeah.
At the very beginning.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and two other things real quick that I want to say is that, going back real quick, it is interesting because Al is very much against Sam pursuing anything with Nicole. Like, not only Sam pursuing anything, but even, like, as Ray. Like, he's just like, no, Sam, that's not what you're here for. Don't do this. This is not good. This
uh-huh.
is don't,
yeah.
you know. Which is interesting. The other thing is that when John O'Malley makes his grand entrance into the after party, like, he immediately finds himself drawn to Nicole as well. Like,
yeah.
just, like, goes, just makes
the
a beeline
new,
for her.
The new, yeah.
Yeah, the
yeah.
new
yeah.
Dulcinea.
Yeah.
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 And
yeah,
like,
yeah, 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 yeah.
Old Dulcinea, which is great because clearly she's younger than
right.
Nicole.
Yeah,
and so she has a little.
And
that.
That just reminded me. So if you're not in the Chicago theater scene, which is 99% of people listening, probably, you know we've had yeah, yeah. I mean, in the last couple of years, we've had a lot of stories come out of different abuse and different just weird
yeah.
situations in the theater scene, and just like in some of these stories come out, like particularly a Profiles theater of like. Of artistic directors and lead actors like playing actresses off of one another.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, yeah, the skeevy thing where he introduces Nicole as the new Dulcinea, like.
Yeah.
It's obvious he is shit stirring and.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, and we also meet Manny in this scene. I mean, we've seen him before.
Yes, obviously. Yeah.
We really kind of meet him at this point, and he's clearly smitten with Michelle. Well, smitten might not be the right word. Lusting Luster, after.
Yes, yeah.
after Michelle.
He would kill just to do her laundry, I think he says in a previous scene. Yeah.
Weird.
And then when Sam goes to the bar to get drinks, though, Michelle goes with him. And at this point, it's pretty heavily implied that Michelle basically, like, stuffs her hands down his pants.
Yeah.
And is just right there at the bar, mm-hmm. you know.
What? I missed that.
Yeah.
Well, there's a scene where she reaches down, and you can tell by the look on Sam's face. Like, she has clearly, if not, like, put hands physically down his pants, she has grabbed his junk.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Sam clearly does not want that. No. He's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He wants the new Dulcinea.
Exactly. Don't give me none of that old Dulcinea.
So when they get...
I feel icky now that I said that.
Yeah. So during this, as he's gone off to get drinks, John has brought Nicole over to talk and has implied that Ray and Michelle have some sort of relationship. But then by the time Sam gets back with drinks... He is passed out on Nicole's lap.
Yeah.
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 And he's been hammered for hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. He did the whole show under the influence of vodka.
Oh, yeah.
That's the thing, too, is, like, we see him coming off stage, like, taking pulls off a flask. Like,
yeah. I do love to jump back. I love the moment where he comes off stage to get a drink, and Al goes, "You are giving a terrific performance."
Yeah,
I am giving a terrific performance.
Yeah, that is pretty great. And John Cullum is great. Like, he's really good. And he's done lots of stuff. He's been nominated for Emmys and awards and stuff. So, I mean, you know, he's good in this role in particular. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the great thing is, like, as great as he is when he's playing sort of drunk, over-the-top, wacky John O'Malley, when he starts to be the more, like, manipulative bastard O'Malley, like, it's just like, oh, God!
Yeah,
like, Like, no wonder this guy is the lead actor in this touring production of Don Quixote, because he's probably arranged to have every other actor killed that tried to take the role. But now, so he's passed out. And
now we get back to
Nicole's
Ray,
place. Right?
Yeah.
So here we go. We'll just set the stage for the scene real quick, and then we'll let Jess and Brooke talk before we say anything else. But basically, Sam goes back to Nicole's place. They're there. She's getting coffee or tea or something.
Tea.
Right?
Funny, this is going to be a real nerdy moment between you and me, but this is where it's established that Sam likes orange spice tea.
Yes.
And that becomes an important plot point in a later episode, and I'm pretty sure in that later episode they use the same set.
Oh, that's
the
hilarious.
Same apartment set.
Huh. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you say orange spice tea?
Mm-hmm.
I miss that.
So yeah, because she says she's the one that says it, right? She's like,
yeah.
Doesn't she say like orange spice? And he's like, it's my favorite. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so at this point he walks over and sits down at the piano and he starts to play, you know, play a little warm up. And that's when she comes out and says, one of my students used to play that. And there's
like she can't remember which student.
And also, it was a very generic warm up that all of her students probably played.
Well, she probably taught him, right?
But it's not the regular warm up. He does a little embellishment at the very end of every scale that is not. It's if you're doing like a regular scales on the piano, it's the da 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 da. But he does not play that. It's like a da 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 da. Like he does like a little embellishment at the very end, which by the way, that really is Scott Bakula playing it because he can play the piano.
Yeah.
But so he does do like a little embellishment at the end that sets it apart enough that I buy her thinking that it's not just. Everybody's warm up.
Maybe.
It's a TV show.
Maybe she's the one that turned him on to orange spice tea.
Ooh.
Oh, that's a great.
Maybe he drank it when he had piano lesson.
Absolutely. Little Sam Beckett going over to Nicole's. She's giving him orange spice tea. I almost said tickle the ivories, but I was just
Thanks for joining us this week. This is Strange Point Wheel.
Good night, everybody.
We're just gonna shut it down now.
So Sam has played the piano. She recognizes it. I will say, in that particular moment, there was a bit of me that wondered if she was being a bit evasive there, but she really wouldn't have any reason to be. But there is an interesting pause where she's kind of like, is she going to tell him about the student, or is she not going to tell him about the student, and then she decides to say, I don't remember, or does she just genuinely like, I can't remember which one it was. But for me, there was a pause there that I didn't know how to take.
Got it.
Anyway.
I just feel like she has a framed picture of her other students. Like, she's clearly close to these kids.
Right.
I just can't. You know, but maybe it's like, I don't want to talk about my piano students on this date with Ray Hutton.
And that's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah.
And also, I think, where, like, Sam doesn't really dwell on it. Like, it's just like, you know, I remember, you know, like, having teachers in high school that I really respected and loved. And, like, seeing them years later and them just, like, I could tell, like, they were, like, What year were you?
Yeah.
Like, trying to remember
right,
me. Yeah. And, like, that realization of, like, you remember teachers that really,
yeah,
that really spoke to you in some way. But then also that realization that not all of your teachers are going to remember
right.
you because
right.
they have so
many
students.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, there's like, 20 to 30 of you and one of them. You know, it's, in that situation, it's a lot easier for you to remember them than it is for them to remember all of you.
Mm-hmm.
So... At this point, also, Sam then divulges that he had a crush on his piano teacher. Now,
mm-hmm.
of course, Nicole thinks that this is Ray talking. She thinks it's adorable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's clearly still attracted to Ray. And then, you know, they're starting to get close. And that's when Sam says, I'm not...
Sam hesitates.
Yeah, he hesitates.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not the same Ray you fell in love with. And she's like, I've changed too. But
I'm not the same Nicole. And then
they kiss.
Yeah.
And let's just go ahead and jump to one quick piece of information. It's clear that that's not all they do, based on Sam's interaction with Al the next day.
Next day, yeah. So it is very clear that they spend the night together.
So,
and by spend the night together, I mean have sex. In case there's any doubt.
Yeah.
So here's the setup. Sam Beckett has leapt into Ray Hutton. Sam Beckett has feelings for Nicole. Sam Beckett is Ray. Nicole sees Ray. Sam ends up fulfilling this childhood fantasy, if you will. I mean, I think it meant more to him than that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
does this thing.
So, women?
It's weird. Yeah. It's weird. And
I was icked out the whole time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think maybe it was just because he just kept emphasizing, like, was it puppy love? It wasn't. And, like, this crush. And, like, really emphasizing their age difference.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I guess maybe, too, the fact that, like, she doesn't know exactly who he is. But I feel like she definitely wanted to be with Ray. She's been with Ray before. So I don't know if I had...
She's also, to me, and I know... times have changed, but, like, to me, it's like her consent was for Ray.
Right.
And she didn't consent to having any physical intimacy with Sam.
Someone else. Who can now have memories of that when
right.
he goes back and can talk about it. And
I think that's the part that icked me out, because I was like, has he done this in other episodes? Like, does he sleep with people in episodes?
Yes.
No.
He has.
Oh.
Not in any previous episode. This is the first time that Sam has sex while leaping.
I don't agree.
He makes out. He makes out with a lot of women.
In Right Hand of God, I still think he had sex with with her.
Oh, see,
with Dixie. I do. Just because of the music playing, the way that she takes off her clothes and climbs on top of him, like all of it. It's like, come on.
Oh.
You know, it's too suggestive.
I will disagree.
And
yeah.
I just don't. I don't think it's the first time that he's had sex in a leap. Again, he's made out with people, but at that point, if we're going to say, you know, if we're going to say it's problematic that he's had sex with someone while leaping, then it's just as problematic if he kisses someone while sleeping, quite frankly.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
So I mean, it's worth having the dialogue about that.
For sure. And we brought this up with a previous episode. I think you guessed it on the episode, or we've talked about it enough, but there was an article out there. I cannot find it. I did another search for it last night.
I actually saw it not too long ago. I know
okay.
it exists.
There's an article out there that does make the argument that any time that Sam sleeps with someone during Quantum Leap, he is technically raping them because they are not giving consent
mm-hmm.
to sleep with Sam. They are giving consent to sleep with the person that they think that he is.
I mean, because if she did know that this was her former, who she last knew as 15 years old, and really... How old is he in real life at this time?
He's in his, he's like 40-something.
Not the Leaping Sam, but the real, his real original timeline. Like, oh, how many years has it been since
79, so he would have been 26.
Okay, so I guess that's not so bad. But that was, like, weird. I would be like, whoa.
Well, if I found out that someone I had slept with, I mean, I'd have a lot of questions. Well, like, maybe some other questions first. But if I found out that someone I'd slept with, you know, had been someone else.
Right.
And
it's
it
like
would
if
feel,
someone lied about their name or anything about their past. And
this is also part of my question from earlier, which is like, so when Ray comes back then, does he know that happened? Or is he going to be like, why are you hitting on me? And like, what happens to these people when they come back?
He may very... Like we talked about, he may have some kind of like vague idea of
maybe
what happened.
Al told him.
But yeah, there are in some later episodes in the last season. There are some episodes where
Ray didn't want to sleep with her. What
if there's also, like I said, it's kind of implied that Ray may have like broken contact with her just by stopping replying to her letters over the years.
Maybe there's a reason.
So.
I don't know.
So, Betsy and I talking about it as we watched the episode last night, she was like, it's like time travel creates weird circumstances.
Yeah.
And, but then her defense of it too was also like, Nicole is clearly into Ray.
Right.
Yeah.
And it may, you know, she clearly wants to have sex and it would be weird and create a weird situation if he didn't have sex with her.
Okay.
What's the harm in that?
Come on. He spent his honeymoon with another woman and didn't sleep with her. Like, he was able to dodge his newlywed wife on the honeymoon and not have sex with her. And even said, it would be wrong if I have sex with her. Like, and yet... He has no qualms about it.
He's at her apartment. Well, all he would have to do is leave.
Yeah.
Back during Honeymoon Express, like Betsy called it out, like his criteria for whether or not to sleep with the woman in Honeymoon Express was whether or not he was in love with her.
Sure.
Yeah, taking nothing into account, her consent.
Right. Yeah. Like.
Or.
Right.
So just because he was in love with Nicole,
he justifies it himself for sure,
and he respects her and cares about her, but it's still. That's great, but, like, she needs to be on board. I don't know. She was on board for Ray.
Right.
I don't know if she was on board for Sam. And that's what makes it a little weird.
I do think that it does bring up a very interesting concept of him leaping around that I think we kind of talked about yesterday. That it is kind of... It does suck. He's not his own life anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He is... You know, been stuck leaping around as somebody else, and I could see him finding the appeal and wanting to, because he kind of says later on, he's like, well, maybe I'll just stay here, you know?
Yeah.
And I totally sympathize with that, that he would feel like, well, I knew her, she knew me, you know, I could see how he would maybe kind of be able to justify it. It's still not okay, I don't think, and it's kind of icky, but it is a very, and I almost wish they would have dived into that more, or maybe they will in the future a little bit, but the idea of how hard that would be to sort of not be living your own life anymore, and he just wants a piece of, like, what he wants to do.
There's certainly a theme that has been building, I would argue, since the very beginning of this season, that is getting Sam closer and closer to... He starts to rebuild his memories of what home was, of who he is, of his brother, of his family, of knowing these things. And one could argue it goes all the way back to the pilot in some ways with the conversation with his dad at the end. But there has been this slow build of, you know, I want to go home. I want to go home. And I think that this is something that I will love talking about as we get closer and closer to the end of this season. But I think that it's there. I think it's subtle, but there have been enough times over the past, like, 10 episodes or so where he has said something about, you know, it's been growing. He's getting tired. He wants to go home. And so I think that it's, you know, it's dangerous to say, oh, I'm going to give him a pass because of extenuating circumstances. But I think that's a valid point. What you were just saying, Jessica, is that, yeah, he's been so out of sorts And he's just kind of finally started to dial in what this whole leaping thing is, and he knows how to get from point A to point B and, you know, leap on, but he doesn't have any life. He even says in this episode, he's like, I have no life. Mm-hmm. I don't have a life.
Right.
And so I'm not giving him a pass at all, but I do think it's interesting to explore it from that heightened, unreal...
I mean, I'm saying it may be more possible to give him a pass. Like, if he had met a woman who had not known the person that he had leaped into.
Yes.
Like, they were, in essence, strangers to one another.
Right.
Yeah. And that's where I can justify him making out with a lot of women during the series, because a lot of those episodes come from circumstances where the person that he has leaped into and the person he is making out with were virtual strangers at the beginning of the episode.
Yes.
They don't think they're making out with a person that they have a relationship with, and it turns out somebody else.
Granted.
But in this case, like, he is fulfilling a childhood fantasy.
I think that might be the piece, is that, like, something about her knowing Sam, like, and knowing Ray is what made it creepy, because I'm like, she's not choosing,
right?
You know, like, mm-hmm. I think you're right. Like, if he had just met somebody randomly new, and then maybe then that would feel different. But I don't know.
Yeah, and there is. I know, like, Scott Bakula didn't mean to come across as creepy, but there was a moment, like, where he says, "I'm not the Ray you knew."
Yeah.
And she says, "I'm not the old Nicole you knew." And Scott Bakula gets a smile on his face, like, it's really subtle, but, like, what I read in that smile was like, I tried. I did it.
Right, right.
I technically told her I'm not Ray.
Yeah.
Full steam ahead.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it wasn't like I was like, oh, he's a monster, but I did just feel like...
It made it a little hard to watch.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like a little like, ooh.
I also wonder too, within the context of the episode as a whole, if there's any sort of validity to, and again, this is not, doesn't excuse it at all, the notion that Sam has kind of regressed a little bit here, just even in maturity. Like, even upon seeing her, like, immediately he's like, take him back to that puppy love phase. Like, and he does, in a way, throughout this episode, act almost more like a teenager in a lot of ways than he does, you know, the normal Sam Beckett. And I think that there's another scene coming up specifically that really is like...
Dials into that.
Dude, you're acting like a little kid.
Yeah. And now, truly, from a practical standpoint, acknowledge, like, different writers are writing Sam from episode to episode. You know,
although it's very interesting,
and
you know,
hard because Sam doesn't have. Maybe I don't know because I haven't seen all the shows, but like, we don't ever see Sam as just Sam, and so it's hard to, as
rarely,
a writer, I would think it would be hard to come in and be like, how do I tap into this person when I haven't even seen them in their environment?
Yeah. It is also interesting to note that the episode was directed by Donald Belisario, who's the creator of the show and the concept, and has written episodes and. I think that his notion of the show to begin with is different from what it has become at this particular point within, you know, the show's history. But it does make me wonder, like, what would be his defense for this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and is there a further argument to be made that because of when the episode was shot, 1989... the notion of a man creating this sort of wish fulfillment situation for himself would not have gone checked at all. Would have just been, sure, dude, do it. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, yeah, but she can't give consent, and that's weird. And again, as I've said before, consent has always existed. We just haven't necessarily always been good about talking about it the way that we should. And in 1989... that conversation would not have been. It's kind of the same thing we were talking about with when he leaps into Samantha Stormer, what price Gloria? Mm-hmm. The way he uses her body,
absolutely,
without her consent, kind of as a weapon to get back at a guy. You know, it's like it's there are clearly episodes that are very problematic in this arena, and I think that this is probably the chief among those transgressions is Sam basically taking advantage of the fact that he has leapt into a person that this woman who Sam Beckett found attractive is attracted to the person that he's leapt into.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably not even something that was talked about, like you're saying, like in the writing at the time.
Yeah.
And I don't even think as a woman, I mean, if I had been an adult woman at the time, that I would have even noticed. Because the conversation was so different than it is now. And it was very tame compared to a lot of the stuff you would see. And I'm not defending it. I'm just saying it's interesting to see it now and have those sort of like immediate, like Jessica and I did, like there's a sort of immediate gut feeling of like, oh, it's so uncomfortable, you know? Whereas maybe it was like, at some point, it was like, oh, it's romantic, he's sweet, he loves her.
Right,
you know,
like,
absolutely.
What I wish that I could have slept with when I was 15 and now I'm older.
Right.
The wish fulfillment thing, I'm sure they were all like, oh yeah, my first grade teacher, blah, blah, blah. You know, I could just see that.
First grade?
What
kind of sicko are you?
Yeah.
No. I'm just kidding.
I have a crush on my first grade teacher.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. It's just a different sort of time, and we're talking about different things, you know? It's funny, because, like, nowadays I'll watch romantic comedies and stuff that are just from the 90s that I loved when I was, like, a teenager, and I watch them, and I'm like, God, like, they're so uncomfortable now to... Just a lot of the behavior and a lot of the stuff is really uncomfortable. So, you know, but at the time you didn't think twice about it.
Well, I completely agree. One of the things I even mentioned to Dennis earlier, and I think I said this to you last night, Jessica, is that this episode had a very special place in my heart for a long time, and I really had fond memories of the episode. And the funny thing is that rewatching it, because of this scene and because of this thread, it took away a lot of that enjoyment that I think I got from other areas of the episode. And I won't deny that, you know, watching this episode as like a 14-year-old or 15-year-old and like that situation certainly in, you know, 1995 would have probably been appealing to me as well. Mm-hmm. But watching it last night, it was a very different experience. And it kind of made me say to Dennis earlier, I was like, well, at least I have the medley on the soundtrack. Because the soundtrack has like a medley of songs.
The soundtrack and the musical aspect of it.
Yeah. Because they bring the episode up, and they don't talk about this, obviously, but in the interview that's with Scott Bakula on the soundtrack,
sure,
they do talk about this episode because of the songs, which is where he talks about Summer Stock and doing, you know, mm-hmm, Don Quixote and stuff. But it would be interesting, really, to get a deeper discussion of this episode from the creative team,
mm-hmm,
and really kind of hear, like, what was it that you were thinking? Because, like, when...
I would venture to guess, like Brooke said, they probably didn't even think about it.
Right, yeah, that's what I was just going to say.
So. Or, like, there's a lot of, like... It's not like, ooh, I thought she was hot and I wanted to get with her. It's like, I loved her. There's a lot of language that's very sweet and sort of romantic. I think it's trying to appeal to the women watching, actually.
Right.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like, oh, well, it's nice because he loved her. And he's, like, age-appropriate now.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm,
he's... And she loves this... The guy, Ray, seems like a nice guy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they made it very nice. They made it...
But that leads you to think, like, he could leap into the boyfriend of a 16-year-old girl and do whatever he wants, really. I mean, if you think about it, like, sure, in this case, she was age-appropriate to his current age, but, like, we would feel, I think, much stronger if he had leapt into somebody who was 16 years old and she thought she was sleeping with her 16-year-old boyfriend, but really it was this 40-year-old guy. I mean, that is clearly problematic. And
think about, and again, I think for the first season episodes, and I want to go back real quick to address Right Hand of God, I still stick to my guns that he did indeed sleep with Dixie. I think because that was sort of proto-Sam, that the character had not really been dialed in yet,
mm-hmm,
they didn't really know what they were doing as far as that sort of stuff went, that it's not the same as Sam in Catch a Falling Star sleeping with Nicole as Sam in Right Hand of God having sex with Dixie. But I think that another episode in Kamikaze Kid, he basically gets that girl's first kiss.
That's what
and
he's
it's
there
Sam.
To do.
Yeah, and Al even, like, heavily implies that he's there to basically give her
Because that's when he leaps out.
Right.
And
let's face it, that was kind of icky for other reasons, because the actor was so, she was so young, and Scott Bakula was not. Like, it's like, how do you feel about that, Scott? Like, and I imagine that he probably was sort of like, all right, well, if you think that this is what we need to do, and her parents are okay with it, like, did they sign a release? But anyway, in all seriousness, I think that, again, that there have been problematic moments prior to this episode that we have addressed, but this certainly seems to be the biggest of them.
And, I mean, it's one of those things where I think it's sort of like, it's sort of just a good example of progress, in my opinion, you
know?
It's like this, it's hard to blame the show for being a show that was filmed in the 80s and that's where people's minds were and that's how people thought. And it's hard to say, like, oh, you know, this writing team was gross or this is, you know.
Right.
Because it was a different time. I think what's good is that we're having this conversation now and we can look at it and feel this way and be like, oh, it's uncomfortable. And men and women are sitting here agreeing that it's uncomfortable now.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part to focus on that's good, at least, that's come from this now. It's like, I don't go back and look at things. I mean, have you ever watched that horrible scene from Holiday Inn that they always cut when they
TV, absolutely. Yeah.
But it's like, well,
Father Abraham.
Holiday Inn, this old, you know, do you know, it's this old black and white Christmas. Well, I guess Holiday movie.
Yeah, but White Christmas is it's where White Christmas premiered was in this movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's like a hotel that's only open on holidays, and then they do a big musical number, and they do one for Lincoln's birthday, and it's all in blackface. And they cut it now, usually when they show it on TV.
But unless it's on Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
They don't do it for... Yeah.
So I never even knew that was part of it until I saw the actual whole movie once. I was like, what is this? And I had no idea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But and I'm never going to... That's a whole different thing. I'm never going to
see
it.
Thing, yeah.
But what I'm saying is, like, at least you can, I guess, tap into the fact that you're like, this is super uncomfortable now. I can recognize that it was made in a different time. Not that that makes it right or wrong, but...
Well, it's the same thing with, like, the tradition of yellowface. It's like, if going back and, like, looking at, like, Charlie Chan movies, or even, like, I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, and one of the most popular Doctor Who stories ever is The Talons of Wing Chiang. And in that episode, a white European actor plays an Asian man.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is at the time, that was, like, kind of like a almost tradition sort of thing. And again, it certainly doesn't make it right, but because it was just so embedded in that particular culture that, you know... that you just got whoever was available, you know, and it wasn't, and here's the thing, and again, not trying to excuse it or say that it's better or okay, but it wasn't Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know what I mean? Whereas that was just bad, no matter what. I mean, that wasn't just yellow face, that was literally just being racist.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that. The thing about Holiday Inn that I struggle with sometimes is that I don't like to think that there's ever a reason to cut that sort of thing out of something. It's the same with, like, old cartoons, like cartoons that were made during World War II, for instance, that are very racially insensitive to Japanese and German culture. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think that it's important, when looked at in the right context, in the right light, it's important to see those as they were. And I think it's the same thing with Holiday Inn. It's important to see it as it was. And it's the same thing about this episode. Like, I would hate to think that, you know, if we go so far with Me Too or Time's Up to say that something like this should be cut or dropped or that episode will not be in the next box set or something like that, I would have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Right, I think what's important, though, is that we just have these conversations about them.
Exactly.
You know? Even those old cartoons now come with, don't they? A lot of them have what's the word I'm looking for?
The disclaimer.
Yeah,
sure.
You know.
Yeah. Well, and even when Holiday Inn airs on Turner Classic Movies, they air like a... I don't think it's a disclaimer so much as just saying, like, you know, in the interest of history, we've preserved the film as originally done. There are some things that you may find objectionable. In that film, too, it's not just the blackface scene, though. It's also how the black children are treated in particular. That is almost, if this is even possible, more offensive than the blackface.
Yeah.
I'm kind of glad you brought that up, because I think that, again, that the most important thing to do is to keep having the conversation and to not allow ourselves to become ignorant of these things.
Right.
And I think if we start to try to take them out, you know, cut those moments out of those movies or, you know, burn those DVDs or whatever, then we create a, you know, kind of an ignorance of it all. And one day, you know, civilization wakes up and thinks to themselves, like, I wonder how things got to be this way. What if we did this? You know, and it's like all of a sudden, you know, we're creating an environment where the same mistakes get made again and again and again.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it's good to... I mean, it's an interesting conversation we're having now based on this. And like we've been saying, like, I don't know if even 5 or 10 years ago I would have thought this much about it when I saw it.
Yeah.
You know? And it's interesting to see how they handle things like this going forward, you know, in movies.
Right.
TV, it's interesting.
Absolutely.
I completely agree.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, like, if they were to write this episode again for, like, today,
yeah,
you would probably see, like, Sam having that struggle of, like, I want to be with her, but I cannot be with her because...
Yeah.
Which, to be honest with you, in my opinion, is a far more interesting episode.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
if Sam leaps in and Nicole is all over him,
yeah,
and he's, like, having to, like, be there with Al and be like, Al, you don't understand, I was in love with her when I was 15 years old. I feel like I want to, you know, what do? I can't do this. It would be wrong for me to do this, but she's coming on to Ray, and it, you know, would create a really interesting,
yeah,
like, ethical dilemma for Sam.
Yeah, which they almost did in Honeymoon Express, but
right,
then they didn't make it about consent. They made it about his feelings for her.
Yeah,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Yeah, and then I think if this were being written today, he would leave the apartment and
yeah,
live with her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
you thank know, you, right. And in some ways, it would make the episode much more touching. You know what I mean? Like,
you'd
honestly,
feel a lot more. For, like,
yeah,
I was saying, I feel bad for him leaping around, not getting to have his own life. He doesn't get to fall in love with anyone. But, you know, to be able to see that struggle versus just, like, giving in to whatever he wants, you would. You would sympathize, I think,
mm-hmm,
with him a lot more, and it would have been more interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
All right, thanks, guys.
We yeah,
solved some of the world's problems
yeah,
again. And,
yeah.
Now we've still got half an episode
yeah, yeah,
here. But
so yeah, so now we get to the next day. Like you were saying earlier, like, they are getting Nicole ready to rehearse.
Yes.
Which I love. Everybody shows up for understudy rehearsal. As someone who has understudy shows, no.
Yeah.
You're lucky you're getting an understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are
you talking about?
And I was laughing, too, because there's, like, everyone shows up for understudy rehearsal, and I'm like, what play are they rehearsing for? There's, like, someone in, like, a legging stretching in the background. There's
yeah,
dancers. There's, like, things everywhere. I was like, what's going on? Like,
mm-hmm,
it made no
what?
Sense.
Yeah.
She was the only one in costume?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was in costume.
Well that I justified. It was, like, they got to get her costume away.
Right.
So
yeah, your fitting.
I understudied a show a few months ago where we got to a point where we had the understudy rehearsals, which, thank God, we had. Like, we got to a point where we were rehearsing in something approximate to what our costumes would be.
Sure.
No, actually, they did actually pre... They got understudy costumes for everyone ready, just in case, actually.
Yeah. I mean, anytime that it's funny, because I've only understudied at one Equity Theater,
mm-hmm,
and so, I mean, anytime that I was understudying for them, they always had, you know, something ready to go. Like, I would do a costume fitting, you know, day one, just like everybody else would do. I would do, you know, I mean, I would be there the whole time. I'd be there.
That's what made me think of the mustache thing, was because you definitely had a more basic, pared down thing.
For
less,
Christmas Carol,
yeah.
Yeah,
less changes, because at Christmas Carol, a lot of people are changing things and doing stuff, but since you were understanding so many characters, it was definitely like, this is a little bit more generic, a little basic
kinda, yeah,
you know, it's a little more flexible. You don't have to worry about as much stuff to do.
And then, yeah, and then at the same time, like, anytime I would understand one of the Shakespeare shows, like, whether it was Midsummer or Julius Caesar, I remember both of those times, it was a very different kind of experience, because it was, again, I was understudying every male character in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Swing understudy work, let me tell you, it is...
That's my last show, yep.
It can be a nightmare, though.
I was understudying three male roles.
Yeah. So I had to have multiple costumes for Midsummer, because depending on who I had to go on for, it was like,
sure,
you have to have a different costume.
Right.
You can't just go on in a basic costume. For Julius Caesar, it was different because it was a little more contemporary, so I just had, like, a suit and I could get away with it,
right,
regardless of who I was going
to
be.
But. I used to work for the Auditorium Theater, and there was all these ballet companies, and
yeah,
those dancers have to be, like, in full hair, makeup, costume, and in the wings, warmed up, and ready to understudy.
Yeah.
Wow. Ready to go. Because if someone gets injured, they just...
Right in the middle, just...
Right,
them
right they
for
just
sure,
come right out, and they pull this guy off, and
yeah,
put this one on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's you know,
yeah, I work at the Joffrey Ballet right now, so...
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah. So I totally...
Yeah.
I know all that.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
crazy.
That's really
yeah,
interesting, because in theater, you would just have to stop the show, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't think... Because the understudy probably wouldn't be there. I mean, maybe you got lucky, and they would be.
I know. I was talking to...
somebody recently, she understudied a show, and I can't remember where it was at, but yeah, she had to be there just in case. She had to stay up until a certain point through the run,
yeah.
like through the performance, and then like after intermission or something,
right.
she was allowed to leave.
I wonder if there's just a higher probability that the dancers are going to need someone to sub in.
Yeah.
Because if you, I mean, if you twist your leg or whatever, like, you could probably keep going through the show if you're an actor, or, you know, you can kind of work through a lot of stuff, but with a dancer, I mean, you can't move.
I mean, I've certainly heard stories theater-wise, though, of where, like, they'll put a book in a production assistant's hand or something like that to finish out the show, because if you've already got the audience in the room,
right.
like,
yeah.
you know, I mean, obviously they're getting a wildly different show in that instance, but yeah, I mean, it is an interesting beast the way it works.
Yeah.
But the last show that I understudied, I was understudying three of the male roles,
mm-hmm.
definitely going on one weekend for one of the roles. It just came a point, like they acknowledged, like, it was too much for any one person to memorize, so they made sure that I was memorized for the one role I was definitely going on for, because
yeah.
it was the most dialogue-intensive role,
yeah.
and it just acknowledged, like, if I got called on last minute for the other two roles, I'd go on with the book.
Well, I it's interesting, because one of the last understudy gigs that I did was for Midsummer Night's Dream at Indiana Repertory Theater, and I'm understanding every single male role except for Bottom, which is a funny story that I'll get to in just a second, and I mean, that was like, what, between the Mechanicals and the Lovers and Puck, and like, yeah, I mean, we're talking like 8 to 10 roles, and I fortunately have a pretty good memory when it comes to that sort of stuff, like, especially being in rehearsals all the time and reading the script daily and that sort of stuff, you just start to kind of get an idea of it, a feel for it. But I was always very fortunate when anytime something would go wrong, because there were very few last minute sort of things, although there was one occurrence of that, I'd get a call like the night before, like, so-and-so is sick, or, you know, we're worried about so-and-so's schedule because his wife is pregnant, and, you know, this guy. So I'd have enough warning where I'd know what to focus on. So there were a couple of the roles I knew, you know, pretty well. The rest of them, it was like one of those things where if I get enough notice, I could probably do it off book. The best is, though, the guy playing Bottom ended up getting, like, walking pneumonia. And he's honestly legit one of the finest actors I've ever seen in my entire life. His name's Henry Warnitz. Look him up. He's on IMDb. His guest spots in Star Trek Voyager are the two finest guest spots in the history of that television show, which isn't hard to do, to be fair, but seriously, the guy's fire, he's great. I've never heard anyone say Shakespeare the way that he does. He's incredible. Anyway, he's sick, and I'm at some sort of function having a beer, and the artistic director and the producing manager of the theater are there, and they walk up to me, and we're just chit-chatting, and one of them says something about, like, so what do you think about Henry being sick? And I was about ready to say, oh, I don't have to understudy Bottom like somebody else would do it. And at that point, the artistic director of the theater puts her arm around me and goes, ah, don't worry about it. We'll slap a book in Sam's hand and it'll be fine. And I was just like, oh, God. Like, that's one more. Like, I didn't know I was going to have to what? And I didn't. I didn't. He soldiered on because, again, he's incredible. But there was just this moment where it was like the combination of one more role, it being literally one of the finest actors I've ever witnessed on stage, and like all of these things kind of combining in one moment, and then the false bravado of the artistic director and me going like, oh God, I hope I can, you know, it's like, maybe I can.
Understudying is so important and so thankless. It's like, you learn this whole thing, you might go on once, you might not go on at all,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, in bigger shows you might be replacing someone that people came to see, so they're going to be disappointed, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
stage managing and understudying are the two most, I think, underappreciated and hardest jobs in theater.
Absolutely. It's interesting. Actors Equity actually now has a national swing understudy day that basically, like, that, yeah, so they, like, try to call everybody out, like, if you're, you know, if you're a swing, like,
sure.
you know, tweet at us or do this or whatever, for that
That's
very
awesome.
Reason, because you're right, it's such a thankless job,
yeah.
like, yeah, along with stage management and, like, production assistants, and,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I mean, stage management and like, PAs and ASMs, though, I mean, at Equity Theaters, like, Jess, you were working, like, what, like, 60-hour weeks and getting paid, like, less than minimum wage?
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, that was a very stressful job, but it was, I mean, it's fun, and it is a lot of hard work, and it is rewarding, and it's own right, but yeah. It's, I think I had more actor's nightmares about, like, being a PA and, like, the giving the wrong prop to a,
yes.
an actor or, like, I don't know, not on the right side of the stage to do the quick change or whatever
yes.
it is.
Yeah. I was a stage manager for a while, too, and I had the same thing. It's, like, the whole show, you're like... You just keep, like, over and over being like, did I do this?
Well, our stage manager would do things like, because we would be backstage, and he'd be like, guys, where's the suitcase? The suitcase is not on stage. And we'd all, like, run to the wings and be like, oh, my God. But, of course, it wouldn't be there. He was just messing with us.
Yeah.
I was a stage manager in an ASM, and that's a terrible job for me because I am just, like, I'm a little bit of a space case sometimes. And I just kind of forget things. I don't know. It wasn't a perfect job for me. I remember I was an ASM on the Fantastics. It was the first show I did in Chicago. And the stage manager got... She was up in the booth and I was backstage. And I thought to myself, like, oh, I really did perfectly today. I think I did everything right. And she gets on and she's like, so, Brooke, on stage right now, right downstage, there is a notebook and a candy bar. And I think they're yours. And I was like, oh my God. And I looked around and I was like, it is my book, like for the, it's the script,
oh,
like
no.
my whole binder, and a gigantic king size Snickers bar. Are just like, right, El Gallo singing next to it, like everything. And I was like, she's like, I'm going to hold the next blackout a little longer. I need you to get out there and get your candy. She was so calm. I was
yeah.
so thankful, but I was like, oh, God. And that's when I was like, I think this might not be for me. Then I went on stage and managed like six more shows.
Yeah.
You know?
Like you. in interest of not giving anyone our full resumes. Like,
for sure, yeah.
Oh, sorry,
but
sorry.
We have editing capabilities.
I'm leaving this stuff in.
All right.
Why not? Why not?
Like a lot of theater memories.
It really has.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah. Like, watch. I'll jump into one here because. And this, so, this next scene we see, like, Sam is, like, sitting in the audience, like, getting ready to
yes.
watch Nicole rehearse. Randomly, there's a person sitting up in the balcony reading a newspaper. And it reminded me. So, in college, I was in Bus Stop, if you're familiar with that show, directed by previously mentioned John O'Malley-esque drunk guy.
Oh,
right.
Boy. Okay.
But they ended up casting a 14-year-old girl. High school girl in the lead.
No.
Because they had decided that none of the girls in our theater department fit the role.
Oh, man.
And there were people in the play, in the theater department, they were really, really bitter about that. Like, why did they bring an outside person? Like, we're a college theater department. You cast from the student body, blah, blah, blah. And even though it was not this girl's fault at all, coincidentally, her name was Nicole. Even though it was not Nicole's fault at all,
sure.
like, there were people who just absolutely hated her. And so, like, one day, we're getting ready to rehearse, and we're rehearsing in the actual, like, theater. Like, beautiful theater, big theater, stadium seating. And so we're sitting there talking, and people are trashing Nicole. Nicole's not there yet. The director's not there yet. I'm just sitting there, guess time, taking the stand. I'm not saying anything, because, like, I don't see what the hate for Nicole is, because, like, it's not her fault. Congratulations, high school girl getting
yeah,
cast
right.
in a college play. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And I look up, and there's a blonde sitting in the back of the theater, just reading a newspaper. I'm like, oh, that's weird. But, you know, the theater's open during the day, and it's a big thing, so, you know, whatever. So we go back to talking, and people are trashing Nicole.
Oh, dear God.
And I look up, and I realize what's happening. And the director shows up. He's like, all right, let's get started. Where's Nicole? Nicole, who recently dyed her hair blonde for the role, put the newspaper down, and she came walking down to start rehearsal.
Oh, poor girl.
She knew exactly what she was doing.
Yeah.
She did not make a scene.
No.
Just individually, throughout rehearsal that day, she just, one by one, when she had a chance, she called everybody out, one-on-one. For the shit they said about her.
Wow.
That's pretty ballsy.
Wow.
Yeah.
For a 14-year-old,
yeah.
that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I would have just probably cried and went home.
But anyway, so...
Well, Cole's now a millionaire. And
yeah, yeah. So anyway, so
yeah.
they're going to start rehearsal, and then stage manager, director, whatever dude,
yes,
call Sam up on stage.
And real quick before we get this, because we didn't mention this earlier, and I do think it's kind of interesting just for texture as well as information about this specific episode, is that Al did say earlier to Sam that, A, you got a photographic memory, B, you
this
can
is more
say,
about to see that. Yeah.
Right, but he actually mentions it earlier.
Earlier, yeah, okay, that's right.
Because one of the things he tells Sam that is really cool that actually plays in one of the novels that they wrote about the show, Prelude, is that Sam used to play the soundtrack to Man of La Mancha while they were working on the project.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is great because it conjures up all these images of the impossible dream and time travel and leaping through time and going to right these wrongs and, you know, tilting of windmills and, you know, Al is Sancho, and like, and so it's like the parallels are there, and it's set, and it's kind of a neat little moment. If maybe a little gratuitous, I don't know. Anyway, now at this point, Sam's now got to actually,
yeah,
be Don Quixote.
Yeah, so he keeps blanking on the lines because he doesn't know the lines, right. And that's when Al shows up with the script.
With the script,
you got a photographic memory. Yeah. Start reading.
Okay. Yeah, photographic memories are not real, right?
I think they're not.
Your faces. I think they're not quite what they're presented at, like, here.
I think there is a sense of that you can have a really great memory. You can kind of remember where things are, but I don't think it's as literal as, like, you glance at the page and now you can read every sentence. I don't think it's quite like that. But I do think that people do have what you could call a photographic memory, but I don't think it's as advanced as sort of the TV makes it seem.
I mean, I don't know. There are people out there. There have been some studies. There are people out there that literally, like, remember every minute of every day of their life.
Yeah, and what's, like, Mary Lou Henner?
And it causes problems for them.
That is true.
Like, because they don't necessarily know what to do with all that information. So but who knows how, you know, authentic it is.
But for this show, he can learn all the lines because he has a photographic memory.
Yes.
Okay. Sure.
But okay. I don't know. I mean, the phenomenon has been...
This says on Wikipedia that the concept... a small number of children and something generally not found in adults, while true photographic memory has never been demonstrated to exist. So some kids can do something that's kind of similar.
Yeah.
But
okay.
There hasn't really been a true, proven photographic memory.
That's bullshit.
I just saw that from memory.
Yeah. Let us know your thoughts right in. Facebook will.
No,
this is how he's gonna do the play.
Yeah.
Because
he
looked at the paper one time. Okay, good.
Yeah. That's.
I say, why doesn't Al just stay on stage with them during the play and hold that script
right,
in front of
yeah.
them.
Well, because they had already gilded that lily a couple episodes ago when he was a blind concert pianist, and Al stood on stage the entire concert holding sheet music for Sam to...
And side coaching is hard enough for a trained actor, much less Sam.
God, I know.
Actually, I like side coaching. I know a lot of actors hate it, but I actually really enjoy it. I've had some really positive experiences with it before. Because it makes things feel so much more alive.
I just want to kill anybody side coaching me.
No, they don't necessarily feed you the lines, but it's like, so when I was in a production of Closer during the strip club scene, I was playing Larry, and the director, and this was actually during the auditions, this wasn't during rehearsal, during the auditions, like, got up in our faces and was, like, super close to us, and we'd be going on, and then all of a sudden he would just say, like, a word, and it was like... It was fascinating because you would think that it would break the connection that you have with your scene partner, but it didn't. Like, she and I just stayed in it and, like, were so connected. And we ended up getting cast. Both of us got cast in it. So, I mean, but it was, I don't know. It was kind of powerful. Yeah. I know some people hate it.
I was going to say, that sounds not... I would not like that.
I don't know. It's just like an extra stimulus. Mm. It gives you something extra to kind of play off of. But you're not supposed to know what's there. I don't know. That's kind of cool. Anyway.
Sure. Anyway. So, yeah, they start rehearsing. They don't get very far when John shows up. He wants to hear Nicole sing.
Why does he like
me? Yeah, yeah, yeah. What does he want to
what make? Does he want me?
Why does he
why
like
does
me?
Why?
Why does he like me?
Sorry.
What does he
like? I actually love Man of La Mancha,
yeah,
too. So.
What does he want to make? Yes.
I'm pretty down on her.
And that's when John has the idea to give the local girl the benefit performance.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Well, and it's great because at first she stumbles with the song.
Yeah.
And I mean, stumbles mildly.
She takes a little bit to warm up.
Yeah, it still sounds good. It's not like she's hitting wrong notes or whatever. But she's a little hesitant. And then it's interesting because I feel like we've seen so many times when, you know, theater or act is being portrayed, that the minute somebody starts to lose confidence in your performance, that automatically derails you. And Nicole does the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. It's like she sees John kind of like poo-pooing her and the other people sort of like, and she's just like, oh, okay, fine. Well, then I'm just going to sing it. And she does. And she nails it. And it's great. And that's when he's like,
yeah,
you're going to go on at the benefit.
Yeah. To Nicole's credit, she got cast 2 days ago. She's off book.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, she might have a photographic memory.
She
We don't know.
Yeah. So I think from here we cut to a scene.
Why
when
she thinks, why does he like me?
Yeah.
Why does he like me? Why does he memorize those
things? So we cut to the bar, and Rachel is quite upset. Rachel, right?
Well,
Michelle.
But actually, where is Rachel coming from?
Because isn't there a Rachel, actually? Isn't that the one that that John initially enters in with?
Anita.
That's her,
yeah.
Okay.
So anyway.
Wait, real quick, we skipped over the Al and Sam scene where Al kind of admonishes Sam.
For, like,
Because it is interesting, because, you know, Sam is usually the ladies' man and kind of a cad, and, you know, and at this particular moment, there's this kind of awkward scene, and it's one of the scenes where I feel like it's intentionally awkward, not just awkward because we're watching it in 2018. But there's this moment where it's like Sam is kind of happy and like has that sort of, you know, you know, the morning after kind of like, I did this thing.
Yeah.
And Al is very much like, no, Sam, what are you doing? And that's when Sam has his outburst about, like, you know, I can't have a life. All I do is live someone else's life, right? Their wrongs, fight their rights. You know, I feel like I'm
not gay, okay, yeah.
But it is kind of an interesting moment because Al is not on board with what Sam did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Al's from the future, and he knows how it is in 2018. He's heard the podcast already.
Yeah,
right. Like,
I mean, it's weird because, like, the way Al is written sometimes, like, you could also imagine, like, Al is like, yeah, right, you got laid last night.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Al says some stuff where I'm like, ooh.
Ugh. Right.
Al. I think Al feels, in this sense, more concerned that he's veered from the mission.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that he's also, there's also an element of concern for his friend. Not so much that he's doing the wrong thing, but that he's not doing something that's productive and something that could potentially even hurt him.
Yeah.
This is also where we start to get that sort of, like, sulky teenager Sam that I was talking about.
Sure.
Because he's not happy about how he got pushed out of the rehearsal and now he can't be next to Nicole professing his love.
Oh, yeah.
Which is also interesting because think about this for a second. Sam, as Ray, as Don Quixote, is professing his love to Dulcinea, as Aldonza, as Nicole.
Yeah.
Like, the layers there.
It's a Russian doll of...
Yeah.
And also, to not... nerd moment. To not give spoilers away, there's also a very... probably also a very strong reason why Al's encouraging Sam not to sleep with anyone.
Oh, well, right. Yeah.
Oh.
Foreshadowing to a future episode.
I don't know what that future episode is, but... I can guess what.
Yeah. So anyway, now we get back to the bar, like you're saying,
and
Sam is looking for...
And, but we get the thing where...
Manny and Michelle first.
Yeah, Manny and Michelle. Like, Michelle is just really pissed off that John, the lead actor, who really... He has no... he has no power or policy to be able to replace actors, but he said,
I guess if he's like
the role
the
away.
Famous guy, though, they do have a little more sway.
That's what I was going to say, because it is, it's clear that the director, stage manager, producer dude,
whatever he is,
and the costume designer, cigarette smoking lady, they are like...
Yeah, she's so
yeah.
But, wasn't that
they clearly hate John O'Malley.
Yeah.
But... They are also very much like, well, if John O'Malley wants this, we'll do it for him.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, because they're deflated at the top of the show, for instance, when Sam can't go on.
Sure.
Yeah.
They're actually sad for him. They're like, oh, Ray, we thought this was going to be your big break.
Yeah.
Anyway, so bar scene, Manny and Michelle.
Yeah,
they're
plotting. Are unhappy about that. But yeah, so then Sam shows up looking for Nicole because they were supposed to get together. And that's like on the fly.
Michelle hatches her diabolical
plan to in short, convince Ray that Nicole has gone up to, quote, rehearse with John.
And she even says, oh, don't worry, she won't be long. At this point, John can't last more than half an hour anyway.
Boy.
Boy. You would know, Michelle.
Yeah.
You would know.
Yeah. So Sam
and
about
she's
to go.
Also, like, again, this episode, Paul Brown, what were you thinking, man? You threw in some pretty... because basically Michelle has, like, prostituted herself to Manny in order to get Manny to play along with her plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Sam leaves, and basically Michelle says one more thing. When Nicole shows up, tell her that I lived with Ray, and then come up to my room.
Yep.
Which is interesting, because I felt like she had enough power over him that she could have just been like, yep, and that's it. And go buy me a drink, too, and he would have done it. But then she, like, does tell him to come up. I was kind of surprised. Maybe she likes him. I don't know. Maybe that's the true love story of this.
maybe that is. Yeah. So Sam goes up to John's room. There is a woman singing in the shower, saying, what does he want of me?
Yep.
And
what does he like?
Why is he not? John comes out. Sam asks for Nicole. I heard you were rehearsing. And John... Nicole?
He pours gin.
Yeah. Hang out.
Like, want a drink?
Yeah, yeah. Hang out with some gin. And then when Sam hears this woman singing, he storms out. And then Anita, who we very briefly met at the very beginning of the episode, she comes out. And this is where you talk about, like, at this point, John is sober.
Yeah.
And you could just, like, he just...
Like, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah, it's like, he's just a bastard. Like, in a moment, like, what am I going to do that's just going to devastate this man?
Yeah, how quickly he realizes that what he thinks the other guy thinks is happening. And he just, like, falls into Michelle's plot without even really knowing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, on one hand, like, you may think, like, oh, he's going to play a little joke because he's going to hang around long enough for Anita to come walking out. And he's going to realize
he got
the wrong thing. But then when Sam walked out, like, he didn't...
He definitely wanted to piss him off.
He didn't stop him.
I have this thing where I have trouble recognizing people, like, even my own friends sometimes. Like,
oh, God, yeah.
And in movies and TV, it's, like, really hard for me to recognize people, especially if there's a lot of characters who look similar. And so when Anita came out of the shower, I was like, oh, and for the longest time I was like, wow. And then I was like, wait, what? And I kept getting all the Anita and Michelle and Nicole confused. I was like, wait, who's what? Who's with who? So as you're telling the story, and I'm like, oh, that makes way more sense.
Yeah. No,
I think I had to ask you. I was like, wait, have we seen this girl?
Yeah, well, that's what we were. I mean, my friend was like, that's not Nicole. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Very briefly at the beginning, like at the first party that they show, he walks up and they make it a point of him to, like, hug and greet her hello and call her Anita.
And we do see Anita, like, dancing on stage a little bit too, but this is the only time that she has lines, I think.
Yeah. She is a plot device.
Yeah. And speaking of plot,
poor Anita.
Moving along.
Mm-hmm.
So then the next day, we come to the mission, if you will.
Yeah.
Which is Sam has got to stop John from falling down the stairs.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Sam gets into makeup and everything.
No, we're missing the scene where he's playing the piano and him and Al have this conversation where Sam is basically sulking, like, playing the piano, like, singing, I think, like, The Impossible Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And Al is like, you're going to save him. Like, no, let him break his neck. And Al's like, well, you know, if you don't save him, you could still leap. Who wants to stay?
Yeah.
And it's just, like, this really confused, like, Al, like, what?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
And this is the only time in the entire series where Sam just flat out says, no.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, like, we saw the beginnings of it earlier when he gets kind of shoved off stage. And it's like that trope. It's funny because, obviously, there are elements that we could talk about the production writer, creator of the show if we wanted to, but we're not going to do that. We're just going to talk about one specific thing about Buffy the Vampire Slayer real quick. Because towards the end of season 2, when Buffy and Angel finally have sex, spoiler alert, it causes Angel to, like, lose his soul, and he goes bad again, and now he's super bad. And Joss Whedon had initially intended that to be the metaphor for, like, when a girl sleeps with a guy and the guy starts being an asshole. And it Sam gets what he wants from Nicole. Obviously, he still, you know, has feelings for her and is pining for her and everything. I'm not saying he turns into a dick. But the minute he feels like he's been pushed away at all, he turns into this sulky teenager.
Yeah.
And like, from the minute he gets pushed out of the rehearsal to then, you know, going after looking for Nicole in John's room, to storming out of the room when he thinks that she's in there with him, to playing the piano and sulking with Al. Like, it's very much this kind of, like, weird kind of regression for Sam, where all of a sudden he is. He's like this, you know, it's like, I don't care, I'll stay here, Al.
Yeah.
You know?
I would have thought that he would have, because clearly that guy's old and creepy and using his power and talent or whatever to get women to sleep with him, to, you know, lure them up to their room to rehearse. Like, wouldn't he have been, like, more, like, going to save her, like, from this creepy guy versus, like,
yeah,
he actually thinks that she wants to sleep with him?
Well, I think, like, when you regress to your, like, teenage self, to put it in a shorthand, like, he just thought
that
he'd been, yeah, he'd just been
But that's what I assumed when he first went up there.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to kind of, like, prevent her from being in an uncomfortable situation, but he just didn't want her to sleep with him. But, like, versus, like, did she even want, I mean...
Yeah. Right, he's not, you're right, that's a good point, he's not thinking about her at all.
No.
He's thinking about,
yeah,
getting his feelings hurt.
Yeah, that would be 2018, Sam.
Right. Yeah, I guess in that time... That's just, it was given that you would sleep with the guy to be able to get the role or something. Maybe he figured she would want to.
So in the scene around the piano, when Sam tells Al that Nicole rehearsed with John last night, Al does have a line that is very Al. Women, they just don't understand the double standard.
What?
Which I think what I've always interpreted that to mean is, like, Al is saying, like, no, like, men can sleep around. But women, like, no, like...
They can't.
Well,
sure. Yeah.
In Thou Shalt Not, he kind of also kind of implies the same double standard, where it's like, if everybody's got to sleep with whoever they wanted to sleep with, the world would be a much better place until their wives found out. And
yeah.
It's like,
so by everybody, you mean men.
Yeah.
You mean men get sleep around.
You know,
so, yeah.
Mad when he thinks Tina's sleeping around on him, but
right.
Clearly he's...
Yeah.
Doing whatever he wants.
He is.
So now we get to
snubs Nicole as well. Like, Nicole tries to talk to him, and he's like, whatever.
Yeah,
Shut my hands in my pockets and storm off.
That creepy old man molest you upstairs? None of that.
It looks like Sam might go on, and then here comes, you know, drunk John walking through, and as he goes up the steps, like, and I will say, like, we've kind of talked about some of the thematic elements and ethical and moral dilemmas that the episode has raised for us as modern viewers, but to speak a bit just about production in general, the scene is actually done very well. The tension of is Sam going to stop him or not going to stop him, plays out well, and there's that sort of that moment, will he, won't he, and then, you know, he just looks up at him, he's like, break a leg. It's like, oh, Sam, that way lies the dark side, Sam.
That way is the dark side, and a bad dad joke.
Yeah, but he is like a sulky teenager, which is interesting because it's like bringing him back to a time when he was a teenager, you know, his piano teacher.
Having that trigger.
Yeah, but he does. I was surprised by that. I was like, Sam.
Right. And then John goes up and he stumbles on the first step, and you think, oh, is this going to be it? No, he's fine. And then he does fall. And Sam's watching the whole thing, and Sam rushes in at the last moment to catch him. Of course, he falls too. And he's like, underneath him and everything. Manny has come over at this point.
Yeah.
And
costume lady has run in.
Yeah.
Cigarette dangling from her mouth.
Still, yeah. And at this point, you got to think, curtain is up. The audience has seen all of this.
Oh, yeah.
You've got the director, stage manager, producer guy, and cigarette smoking lady on stage as well. Like, everybody's there, crowded around him. He gets up, and he's like, I am John O'Malley. I have gone on for 736 performances.
I shall not
go on to
Sally Forth.
Yeah. And so now Sam is going to go on. We also get the piece of information that Manny drops to him.
Yeah.
That, you know...
They didn't see the piece. And also, we skipped over part, like, earlier in the dressing room.
Oh, right.
Because Nicole on the other side of this episode, that Ray had spent the night with Michelle.
Exactly.
And the costume lady says, like, no, like, Ray wouldn't touch Michelle with Don Quixote's lance.
Yeah.
This is such a gossipy episode.
Right?
So this actually, my
the rest of my theater experience was really lame, but my community college theater experience, it was like this. Like, yeah. Everybody, oh, yeah. There were love triangles, sure. And quad angles, and octagon. Yeah, yeah, everybody was, there was one performance of Charlotte's Web.
Wow.
Where, what was the name? I don't think the character really had a name. Like, Eli, one of the farmhands, was sleeping with Templeton the Rat's girlfriend, who was one of the narrators. And so right before the performance, in costume, Templeton the Rat walked up and tried to punch Eli the farmhand, slipped in his Templeton the Rat costume, and just, like, totally whiffed the punch.
Oh, my God.
There was stuff like that going on in my community college theater department.
So a couple of years ago, I guess it was about 2 years ago, I went back to my school. They hired me to come in and play Edmund in King Lear, and so I went down there to do that, and brought back lots of memories, let me just put it that way, that I was fine with just leaving the past, exactly what you're talking about, like, who said what about who, who's sleeping with who, oh, you did what with where and who, when, and what professor did what, you know, like, just like, oh my God.
Especially when it's, like, summer stock or college, where you're just, like, in this little bubble of people, and they're the only people you ever see, it's, like... Endless, every day.
Incubator for drama.
So, last skeevy bus stop story to bring it home. So we were getting ready, we were trying on costumes, and so Nicole, 14-year-old actor Nicole, she was in a dressing room trying on costumes. Creepy John O'Malley-esque drunk director comes in. He comes in to the room adjacent, because it was the green room was in between the two dressing rooms, and you can enter from either one. So, we're standing in the green room, and the director comes in. He goes, "Hey, where's Nicole?" And we're all saying, she's in that dressing room changing. And he goes to walk in the room, and he goes in the room. He opens the door. He pulls a Donald Trump and goes into the room while we're all shouting, "She's changing! She's changing! She's changing!" And he opens the door, looks at her changing, and goes, "Oh.
Oh, my God."
And then slowly closes the door.
God. Yeah, you told me that story before.
It's terrible.
You know, and I just thought in the back of my mind, we've gone two whole episodes without mentioning Donald Trump, and you just had to ruin it.
Anyway, there we go.
Sam goes on stage.
Sam goes.
That's right. Theater's gross.
So at this point, now Nicole knows that Ray, Sam did not sleep with Michelle. Manny then tells Sam that Nicole did not sleep with John.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, sulky teenager Sam has now become empowered actor Sam, who will tame the role of Don Quixote.
Yes.
And we get this montage, this musical montage.
It's so long.
It is long.
And it's that's why I was laughing. I was like, a little thin on plot this episode, but pretty heavy on Scott Bakula. Is a singer.
Writing to,
Which,
he's
again,
good, though.
Yeah, he is. He is, again, Tony nominated, had done Summerside, had played Don Quixote before. He had the chops for it, without a doubt. It's an interesting scene. As a theater kid in particular, in high school, I remember just being very attracted to this episode, I think, because of these moments, and just, I'd be like, yeah, that's what I want to do, and I'm going to, and I've done one musical because I'm not big for musical theater. But anyway, it left a mark on me, and I think even after watching the episode, I can safely say I do have fonder memories of the soundtrack medley,
sure.
Which also has Scott Bakula singing The Impossible Dream, which obviously he does not do within the context of the episode, because it's the finale Impossible Dream as opposed to the original Impossible Dream, which he does sing, but this is the finale where all the other characters sing it to him as he's being let out. Which, that's the interesting thing, too, about this. It's another texture, layer, if you will, is that Man of La Mancha is a play within a play.
Yeah.
And we're watching a play within a television show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About a guy who's playing someone else. Basically, yeah. It's kind of you know.
I mean, it's very. I mean, like they very intentionally picked this one.
Yes.
Like,
I had read
originally
this before,
it was
My Fair Lady,
but it's also a Matt's book. Yeah, they also toyed with the idea of My Fair Lady being the.
And then they decided, no, we got to do Mayla Macha because
all the connections,
the parallels.
Yeah.
Another thing that's interesting about the episode is as it ends, there's that moment where Don Quixote is dying and he's in Dulcinea's arms, and Sam looks up at Nicole and says, "I love you, Nicole." And she says, "I love you, Ray." And it's this interesting moment where it's just sort of like, again, doesn't excuse anything that's come before, but is that the moment where Sam gets it? Do you know what I mean? Like, is this the moment where Sam is finally like, right, this is, I shouldn't have done any of this. Now I gotta walk up those stairs and get out of here with as much grace and dignity as possible.
Oh, I didn't get that. No,
see, I always think like the sad, forlorn look that he's walking up the stairs. Like, by this point in the series,
he does take like three looks back.
Yeah. But by this point in the series, we've established like he has a pretty good sense of when he's about to leap. I think
right.
he knows when he gets to the top of the stairs, he's leaping.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he's dragging it out.
And then he does.
Does he usually leap pretty quickly after he's completed his test?
Right? Yeah, sometimes like while it's kind
of. Well, it's weird because like the last episode we just talked about, like there was like the climax of the episode and the denouement. However you pronounce it.
Denouement.
Okay, yeah. The denouement, like, obviously from what they talk about in that scene, like, we're obviously, like, 2 weeks later. And he's been there the entire time.
Although one could argue in that case, and so help me God's case, that his actual purpose was to give her the reader.
Yes.
To help teach her to read. And
yeah.
not actually, I mean, it was also, yes, to make sure she was not,
yeah.
you know, convicted of murder. But yeah, it is interesting because... Yeah, he has to complete the performance in order to actually leap out.
Sure.
But he does, he completes the performance.
Poor Ray didn't get to have his moment on stage. He didn't get to say,
I love you to Nicole.
And now Nicole's going to be like, "Hey, Ray, I love you." And he's like, "What?"
Yeah. Well, now to your point, Ray's going to leap back in. She's going to rush backstage afterwards because they just had this like really touching thing on stage. And Nicole's going to be like, "Hey, want to get together tonight?" And Ray's like, I ditched you after Juilliard.
Right, no.
Like, what?
I thought I made it clear. I'm not
You're super annoying.
Well, and then he leaps out. He's in a cemetery in a trench coat. Gets his flashlight.
Yeah.
Looking around. Turns around. There's a woman in a white dress.
Yeah. There's Deborah Pratt.
Deborah Pratt. That's
yeah.
right.
Oh, huh.
Which, oddly enough, is not the only time we see Deborah Pratt this episode because there's a curtain call for this episode. It's very strange.
Yeah.
You see Donald Belisario. You see Deborah Pratt. You see, you know, other people involved with the production.
Yeah.
Obviously the entire cast and, you know, everybody in...
Yeah. Betsy and I were watching this last night, and we got to this very part right here. She's like, "What the hell's happening? What?
I saw someone touch Al, and I was like, "Oh, this is outside of the realm of the show."
Yeah,
because obviously they see Al there,
right.
so it's
yeah.
not Al.
Well, it's like it's funny. Like you watch it, it's like there are some very 80s hairstyles and stuff
yeah.
going on from the production
Tom
staff.
Selleck look alike.
Oh yeah, I thought it was hilarious that there's like two dudes that kind of look like Tom Selleck.
Sure.
I was
yeah.
just sort of like, "Oh, that makes sense because Magnum PI."
Yeah,
but
wait, I think I missed. What are you talking about?
At the very...
The last thing I saw was the cemetery.
Uh-huh.
And
well, the closing credits, like, instead of doing, like, the few, like, stills and the theme song,
oh.
they actually did, like, in the actual
curtain
production
call.
Of the episode, like, they actually had, like, the production team do, like, a curtain call.
Cast photo.
Like,
kind of
on the set kind of thing.
Gotcha. Oh, I didn't see it.
Yeah.
Which platform did you watch this on?
Hulu.
Interesting. I wonder what they...
I don't know.
We might have just turned it off because we thought it was over.
Sure.
So going back real quick, one other thing I want to mention, which is very interesting because Dennis and I noticed it, and of course I think it's, you know, or no, not I think it is, it's mentioned in Matt's book as well. The shot that they use before, you know, Sam goes on for the final performance is the same shot from the very beginning of the episode, and the reason you know this is because
Nicole
is standing on the other side of the stage in her purple dress, even though she's on stage as Dulcinea at that moment.
Yeah.
Which we normally don't mention goofs like that, but it just like, something that kind of stuck out to us. So you're like, "Oh, how about that?"
It's television. It's a production.
So, there you have it.
I didn't realize, speaking of like different, I don't think we got one shot of Al in this episode walking through anything. Or
I don't
did something
think we did the last episode either?
Or did something? No, in the last episode, he walks through the judge's bench at one point. Because Sam freezes up because he doesn't know what he's going to do, and Al shows up.
That's right.
But this one, like, there may have been something where something like goes through him backstage
at the top of the show.
We don't get a hologram shot.
No,
in this one.
So this was sort of like a unique episode among
concepts. It was unique in the fact that Sam encounters someone from his own.
Yeah. It's also unique because it is one of the few episodes that, you know, he doesn't have to save someone from dying.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to ensure someone gets married or, you know, like, there's basically, like, a few things that crop up again and again and again, saving lives.
Well, we didn't also get any sense of, like, if he had fallen and broken his leg, like, what would have happened. Basically the same thing that did. Ray would have gone on.
Yeah. Well, right, but Al does say that,
right?
It would have ended. This is actually
ended
the fascinating
O'Malley's
thing.
Career.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
He's basically there to save John O'Malley's career.
Gotcha.
That's
yeah.
why Sam is there.
Yeah.
I mean, his career didn't seem
it's
like it deserved to be saved.
Well, that is interesting now that we think about it.
Yeah, like, what was the real, like, it really deserved him leaping back just to help this guy not break his leg?
Oh, well,
so
and you
we
know,
can continue to harass more young actresses
yeah.
who take the role and get playing opposite him.
And here's
yeah.
here's another interesting thing about that, actually, is there are times when Sam has leaps where he thinks he's being rewarded for things, possibly. There are some things that get set up in this second season in particular that I do think that pay off in interesting ways. Whether they were intended to do this or not, or they just were sort of like saying, like, oh, well, we did this, let's do this. I'm not saying there was a master plan, because that just wasn't TV at the time for the most part. But there are some very interesting payoffs down the road, or things that make you kind of think back and go, was that, you know, was that maybe this? It's all fictional, so who the hell knows? But there is an element of, like, was this leap actually meant to teach Sam a lesson as opposed to, you know,
oh,
for
see.
Him to save John O'Malley's career?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing
yeah.
is, there is a lot to be said for that, but I don't know if he actually learned anything. Like, he got, he got to have sex with his teenage crush. But I don't know if by the end of anything, like, he... I don't know. I mean, like, yeah, he does find out that he assumed wrong with what had happened. But, like, we don't have this moment of reckoning where he's like, oh, I made an ass of myself.
Yeah.
I need to do some thinking.
So here's the weird thing that I'm going to say right now, is in spite of all of its flaws, I still kind of come out of the episode being like, I don't hate it.
No.
I don't hate it. And yet, I cannot, for any reason whatsoever, say that it's a good episode.
I mean, it's just kind of blah, I thought.
Yeah.
Like, there's some problematic stuff, and there's a few things that are, like, potentially interesting, like, with his whole, like, I don't want to be doing this anymore, but it just, it wasn't very exciting.
You know, it could be, like the set piece was, they're doing Man of La Mancha.
Right.
Which makes this a unique episode by doing, like, a little mini musical.
Right.
Within
mm-hmm.
the thing. But then, yeah, the writing around it is kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question. There is this one line that stuck out to me where Al says, it's not up to you, it's up to him.
Mm-hmm.
And points out, do they touch on this religious stuff sometimes?
Yeah, they do. It's interesting you bring that up. In our last episode, we were talking a little bit about that because in the last episode, So Help Me God, there's a lot of talk about the Bible and religion and about God. Okay, not a lot, but there's a bit.
Sure.
There's a chunk of it. And it is something that they've addressed in other episodes. The interesting thing is that Dennis has mentioned this before. They really, at this point in the show's history, were kind of steering hard into the idea that it was God that was leaping him around. Now, as the show goes on, it becomes God, time, fate, or whoever. And I think that that kind of becomes the thing that, you know, the show is kind of known for or whatever. But yeah, at this point, it was definitely more like, God is doing this. And yet, there's no real sense of, like, I never feel like the show's preaching to you. I never feel like it's...
It's
yeah.
just assumed that it
yeah.
I always felt like in putting, like, stuff like this in there, I always feel like the show was just pandering a little bit to religious people, because a show where a guy, like, goes around, like, putting right wrongs.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a show. Like,
I mean, it's Highway to Heaven
people.
With time travel.
Yeah, I mean, we've said it before. Yeah, this is a sci-fi Highway to Heaven. So I always felt like the God thing was always just a little bit of pandering.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Or somebody, one of the writers, was pushing their own agenda a little, I guess, and feeling like they wanted to put that in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just jumped out at me. I was like, what? Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, it is up to Sam. Is he going to catch that falling star or not?
That's right. Catch a falling star.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm such an asshole. I'm pretending like I'm so smart. I just figured that out on the bus here. I was like, oh, I get it.
Yeah. I feel like it's one of those things that I had known before, but it just, like, completely... And now it's like, oh, my God!
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't
but see, again, it reinforces the thing that he is literally there to save John O'Malley's career. Like, that's what he was sent there to do.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also, like, if you only have, you know, X number of missions that you're going to complete, is that really one of the most important
right?
things? I don't know.
And that's because the show never really goes too far beyond like the you know the spider web or the ripples in the pool of what time travel would mean. It's fascinating because like other times then the stakes are high because it is like somebody's gonna die or something like that. It's like you get that, you know, or you need to save a marriage or you need to make sure that this kid gets accepted or whatever. Like that stuff kind of makes sense. But this one is just sort of like, what on earth could John O'Malley have done past 1979,
yeah,
that would warrant him and his career still being alive. You know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They don't say, like, we need him because he...
Yeah. But, you know, to bring around, talk about, like, last episode, he hung around for 2 weeks and didn't leave until he gave Lila the reader.
Right.
If he was truly just there to save John, he would have leapt out right after he saved John, and Ray Hutton would have come back just in time to perform.
Yeah,
maybe Ray kind of sucks, but because... He rocked the show so much. Now Ray,
can have
good.
Yeah, I was gonna say Ray's gonna have some kind of opportunity.
And everyone's
now.
Like, "Well, he was good that one time, but I'm gonna guess."
But then after that, he just kind of
He's helped Ray's career.
Maybe Ray and Nicole stay together.
I think really though, it was just to showcase Scott Bakula singing.
And that's okay.
Yeah. How would Nicole not be like, hey, Ray, remember how we slept together a couple nights ago? And then Ray'd be like, what? And then wouldn't she have a lot of questions, like, after that? Like,
you know, there'd be like,
no, that's
you
just
know,
like regular guys sometimes.
Yeah. I'd be like, or she'd be like,
why are you being so weird to me?
Yeah. She was like, that's weird. You did say you're not the same Ray.
Play that piano thing again, Ray.
Yeah. I can't play piano. What?
Wait a minute, are you a time traveler looking at your body?
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Anyway, on that oh boy note.
Yeah, indeed. Brooke, thank you so much for joining us.
It was so much fun, and
yay.
I am going to go home and watch so much Quantum Leap.
Yay!
I love it.
Well, you are welcome back anytime.
Yay!
Yeah, especially if if you do end up watching more and you see an episode you want to come back for, let us know.
That you have commentary on.
Yeah.
How many seasons are there? Five?
Yes,
five seasons, 97 episodes.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, this is exciting.
Yeah.
I'm a fan.
Yay! there's some really good episodes in the second season, and I would even say if you wanted to, like, go back to the beginning of the second season, because there are some really great ones that we just did episodes on. But there's still great ones coming up, too. I'm not a huge fan of the next one. I just feel like it's, I don't know.
I like it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so next week we're going to be talking about A Portrait for Troyan.
Yeah. Portrait for Troyan.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said it that way. All right. Anyway, Brooke, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jessica, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll see you in about 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Yeah.
Where are you going?
I got to leap out of here.
Oh!
And on that,
thank you. Talk to you later.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at www.quantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time.
and time. I want to stay, I want to go. You see my face, but it's not mine. But you can see, you'll never know. How can we meet if I'm not there? Our hearts may touch, our bodies close, but time divides what we might share and sends us all where no one goes. I'm just a traveler upon the sea of time.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.